is Guns and Butter. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today, of course, is a fundraiser for KPFA Radio, listener-sponsored, non-commercial here in Berkeley. I'm happy to be participating today, and I have a great guest coming on with me live in just a moment, Barbara Honecker. But first, I want to let you know what we're going to be doing. We're going to be playing the first 20 minutes of a presentation by Dr. David Ray Griffin that hasn't been heard. It's called 9/11, Why Do Bill Moyers and Robert Perry Accept Miracles? And this is really Dr. Griffin's take on the left gatekeepers. Barbara, are you with me?
I am. Hi, Bonnie.
I wanted to let everybody know, Barbara, that you're well-known, but for those of you who don't know you, I'd like everyone to know that Barbara Honecker is a leading researcher and author. She held high-level positions in the federal government during the Reagan administration, including White House policy analyst. Her pioneering book, October Surprise, is the deep story behind the Iran side of the Iran-Contra scandal. Her research into what happened at the nation's military headquarters on September 11th is a three-hour video presentation, Behind the Smoke Curtain, What Happened at the Pentagon, What Didn't, and Why It Matters. Well, welcome, Barbara. Could you say...
Oh, welcome, Bonnie.
Well, wonderful to have you help me here with this fun drive, which is so very important to keep our radio station and our network on the air. I always like to remind everyone that this is a real radio station. This is not just internet radio. Could you say a few words about Dr. Griffin's presentation, 9/11, Why Do Bill Moyers and Robert Perry Accept Miracles? After all, you and I sort of came up with this DVD.
Yes. And I would like to preface it by just encouraging everyone to please support Pacifica KPFA Radio. KPFA is a crown jewel of independent public-supported radio, and Bonnie is a national treasure. So please, please call in with your support. So what we're about to hear the first, I believe, of two excerpts from is an extremely important DVD video by Professor David Ray Griffin. For those who don't remember or don't know, is literally the dean of the 9/11 truth movement worldwide. Professor Griffin is the author of 11 books, if you can imagine, 11 books on what really happened on 9/11 and what didn't. And he is one of my true heroes, and I know he's one of your heroes too, Bonnie. Well, what you're about to hear an excerpt from is a presentation that Professor Griffin gave at Seattle Town Hall. Now, he gave this, as I recall, in fact, I know, and I'm going to briefly tell you how I know. Professor Griffin gave this presentation at Seattle Town Hall, a professional public presentation, to a standing room only audience. It was the very first public address that he gave after literally almost dying. Professor Griffin had a number of amazing medical procedures that he miraculously survived. And it weakened him very greatly, but he came back to life. And one of the very first things, if not the first thing, he said to his wife when he came out of what amounted to a coma was, I have to get back to 9/11. I have to get back to 9/11 truth. Bring me my paper and pencil. And when he was able to stand and walk and was strong enough to give his first public address, this is the address that he gave. This is the address, and this is the content that he felt was that important. So I don't know if you would like me to give a thumbnail sketch of what it is, or if you'd like to just go into people listening to the first excerpt, and then we'll comment on it.
All right. Well, let's go ahead. We're going to play about 20 minutes. This, of course, is called 9/11, Why Do Bill Moyers and Robert Perry Accept Miracles? It's sort of also commonly known as his discussion of the late gate, of the left-wing gatekeeper. So, Erica, let's get started.
A few people from the beginning started saying that the official account of the attacks, according to which they were carried out by foreign Muslims in other countries, was false, and that 9/11 was an inside job carried out by people and agencies in our own government. An emerging movement to make this case came to be called the 9/11 Truth Movement. This movement argued from the beginning that 9/11 was a false flag attack designed to allow the Bush-Cheney administration and its Pentagon to attack Afghanistan and then Iraq. But most of the traditional anti-war journalists, such as Noam Chomsky, George Monbiot, Norman Solomon, and Matt Taibbi, along with the writers at Counterpunch, In These Times, The Nation, Mother Jones, The Progressive, and Democracy Now!, did not endorse the 9/11 Truth Movement. Most of them, in fact, attacked it. In the first years, to be sure, we did not have a very impressive membership, as our movement had few professionals in the relevant disciplines, such as physics, architecture, and engineering. But in 2005, physics professor Stephen Jones started explaining why the World Trade Center buildings could not have come down without explosives. Due to some books and coverage by C-SPAN, professional organizations began to form, including Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. By now, we have a dozen professional organizations, including Firefighters for 9/11 Truth, Intelligence Officers for 9/11 Truth, Journalists for 9/11 Truth, Medical Professionals for 9/11 Truth, Military Officers for 9/11 Truth, Political Leaders for 9/11 Truth, Religious Leaders for 9/11 Truth, Scientists for 9/11 Truth, and Veterans for 9/11 Truth. The 9/11 Truth Movement is now very impressive in both size and professional membership. Nevertheless, the traditional anti-war leadership has continued to distance itself from the 9/11 movement. There have been a few notable exceptions, including Richard Falk and former CIA analysts Bill Christensen and Ray McGovern. But most of the anti-war leaders have maintained the stance they took in the first years after 9/11, in spite of all the changes in the 9/11 Truth Movement in the intervening years. For example, when I was interviewed on Democracy Now! In 2004, the main argument against my position was that I could not name one structural engineering expert who said it is not feasible that the planes caused the towers to come down. The movement's lack of architects and engineers at that stage constituted a persuasive argument. But now there are 1,500 members of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth who say it is not feasible that the planes caused the towers to go down. So one would suppose that Democracy Now! Would have reassessed its position, but it has not. Progressive journalists in general have not availed themselves of the evidence provided by the 9/11 Truth Movement to argue against the legitimacy of the so-called war on terror. If any major journalist could have been expected to do so, it would have been Bill Moyers. Moyers began his public life by working for President Lyndon Johnson, ending up as the White House press secretary. But having become increasingly opposed to Johnson's war in Vietnam, Moyers resigned in 1966. Next, becoming the publisher of Newsday, Moyers turned this conservative paper into a progressive organ, which in 5 years won 33 journalistic awards, including 2 Pulitzer Prizes. Then, after a brief stint at CBS, Moyer spent most of the rest of his professional life at PBS, producing and writing the Bill Moyers Journal. In these programs, Moyers argued that democracy cannot coexist with a permanent war state. His 2007 program on the secret government exposed ways in which presidents have deceived the people to promote war. And another 2007 program, Buying the War, showed that the media, instead of exposing truths that could have prevented the war in Iraq, served as cheerleaders. However, while driving home the fact that the media failed to expose Saddam Hussein's lack of weapons of mass destruction, Moyers failed to expose Osama bin Laden's lack of responsibility for the 9/11 attacks. And then in 2011, he attacked the 9/11 truth movement. After criticizing Rush Limbaugh and Fox News for providing disinformation that undermines the truth needed for democratic self-government, Moyers added, "Disinformation is not unique to the right. Like other journalists, I have been the object of malevolent assaults from the 9/11 truthers for not reporting their airtight case, proving that the Bush administration conspired to bring about the attacks on the World Trade Center." In speaking about this airtight case, Moyers was, of course, using sarcasm. Considering this case anything but airtight. In fact, he said that the truthers, having no real evidence, simply cherry-picked a few supposed anomalies to build an inside job storyline. In criticizing this case, Moyers was paraphrasing an independent journalist, Robert Perry, who said, "Lacking any real evidence, the truthers have built their case on alleged anomalies in the collapse of the buildings." And drawing on Perry, Moyers appealed to one of the best of the independent journalists. Having helped to reveal the Iran-Contra affair, and having been the first journalist to report Oliver North's involvement, Perry received the George Polk Award for Journalism in 1984 and was a finalist for a Pulitzer the following year. In 1995, having resigned from both the Associated Press and Newsweek because they put brakes on stories he wanted to report, he created Consortium News, the first online magazine of investigative journalism. What distinguishes Perry's project from the mass media's cyber ventures, Norman Solomon wrote, is his passionate belief that journalism has a responsibility to follow the trail of the truth wherever it leads. In 2004, explaining the motivation behind Consortium News, Perry wrote, "The consortiumnews.com website was meant to be a home for important, well-reported stories that weren't welcome in the conventional, wisdom-driven national news media. I was distressed by the silliness that had pervaded American journalism by the mid-1990s. I feared, too, that the decline of the U.S. press corps foreshadowed disasters that would come when journalists failed to alert the public from impending dangers." In concluding that 2004 essay, Perry said, "The fight for honest information is a battle for the future of American democracy." Given Perry's commitments, we would have expected him to expose the truth about 9/11. And there's still another reason why we should have expected this. After Perry had won his awards for reporting about the Iran-Contra affair. He delved more deeply into this story, finding evidence to support the theory that the Reagan-Bush administration's contact with the Iranian government of Ayatollah Khomeini had begun years earlier, during the 1980 presidential campaign. President Jimmy Carter was trying to negotiate the release of U.S. citizens being held hostages by the Iranian government. The Republicans reportedly feared that Carter would arrange an October surprise, a last-minute release of the hostages, which would guarantee Carter's re-election. But Perry moved toward the theory that the Reagan-Bush campaign had worked out a different October surprise, according to which the Iranians, in exchange for weapons for their war with Iraq, would hold the hostages until after the elections, thereby virtually guaranteeing victory by the Republicans. This theory had been argued in a 1989 book entitled October Surprise by Barbara Honegger, who had worked in the Reagan White House until she resigned for reasons of conscience in 1983. But Perry publicly endorsed this view only after he had investigated the claims for himself, uncovering additional evidence. Having left Newsweek in 1990 after it insisted that Perry quit reporting about Iran-Contra, he was approached by PBS's Frontline to do a special about the October Surprises allegations. Perry knew his career would be improved if he joined other journalists in debunking the charge that the Reagan-Bush ticket had won the election by means of a dirty trick. However, finding multiple testimonies that George Bush, then the Republican vice presidential candidate, and Bill Casey, the Republican campaign chairman, met with Iranians in Madrid and Paris in 1980. His 1991 Frontline program, which came the same week as a New York Times op-ed by Iranian expert Gary Sick, led to a congressional investigation. But these allegations were widely denounced in the press, and Democratic Congressman Lee Hamilton, who headed the Congressional Task Force, declared that the theory of a secret deal had no credible evidence. In reality, there was a lot of evidence. The brother of Iranian banker Cyrus Hashimi said that he and his brother had met with Casey in Madrid on July 27 and 28, 1980. And testimony that Bush and Casey had met with Iranian officials was provided by former Iranian President Bani Sadr, by Russian intelligence, and by the biographer of France's chief of intelligence. However, Hamilton and his chief counsel, Lawrence Barcella, hid some of this evidence and disputed the rest of it by means of false claims and ludicrous alibis. For example, Newsweek and the New Republic declared that Casey could not have been in Madrid on July 27 and 28 because he was at a historical conference in London. The press declared this evidence proved the October surprise to be a myth. However, the attendance sheet for this London conference, Perry discovered, showed that Casey did not arrive until 4 p.m. on the 28th, so he could have had meetings in Madrid on July 27 and 28, as the witnesses had testified. Although Newsweek and the New Republic, confronted with this disproof of their claim, refused to print retractions, Lee Hamilton simply sought a better alibi for Casey. His task force claimed that from July 25 to 27, Casey had been at the Bohemian Grove near San Francisco, after which he flew overnight to London in time to arrive at the historical conference by 4 p.m. on the 28th. However, documentary evidence showed that Casey attended the Bohemian Grove in August, not in July. Hamilton's task force, nevertheless, stuck with the Bohemian Grove alibi. One task force member, Democratic Representative Merv Dimely, recognized the absurdity of the alibis and planned to dissent. But Hamilton used threats to get him to remain silent. So the task force's report was accepted without dissent. Hamilton then wrote a New York Times op-ed entitled Case Closed, in which he stated that the task force's findings should put the controversy to rest once and for all. Consequently, Perry wrote, Washington's conventional wisdom quickly solidified around the judgment that the October surprise story was a loony conspiracy theory. However, in spite of this conventional wisdom, Perry did not recant. Indeed, he founded ConsortiumNews.com in large part because of new documents that put the history of the 1980s in a new light, showing especially that the Reagan-Bush team had won the presidency in 1980 by virtue of a dirty trick that bordered on treason. But the press continued to hold, Perry wrote, that the October surprise story was a bogus conspiracy theory, despite the fact that many of the same Reagan figures had been caught lying about the secret Iran-Contra guns for hostages negotiations in 1985 and 86. Perry's continuing insistence on the truth and importance of the October surprise, wrote a sympathetic journalist in 1996, has made him persona non grata in the media establishment. Perry himself said, "It used to be that you were admired if you took on a tough story. Now you're portrayed as a nut." Given Perry's commitment to truthful journalism, combined with his awareness that the October surprise became relegated to the status of bogus conspiracy theory only because of lying politicians and careless and dishonest journalists, we would have expected him to engage in meticulous reporting about the 9/11 truth movement's descent from the official story about the 9/11 attacks. We would have expected him to be suspicious of the official account because it was provided by the Bush-Cheney administration, which is now known to have lied about Iraq. And we would have expected Perry to be even more suspicious about the official story of 9/11 because the chief of the lying politicians in the October surprise case, Lee Hamilton, served as the Democratic co-chair of the 9/11 commission. Moreover, Perry could have learned in a book on the commission by New York Times writer Philip Sheehan that Hamilton's duplicitous ways continued in his new role. Hamilton, together with Republican co-chair Thomas Kane, appointed Philip Zelikow to be the commission's executive director, even though Zelikow was essentially a member of the Bush White House. Hamilton also, with Kane, concealed from the staff the fact that Zelikow had written a detailed outline of the commission's final report, complete with chapter headings, subheadings, and sub-subheadings, before the staff even had its first meeting. For all of these reasons, we would have expected Perry, as well as Moyers, to have done good reporting about the 9/11 attacks. They instead used bad reporting to attack the 9/11 truth movement's claims that 9/11 was an inside job. Both Moyers and Perry, as we saw earlier, said that the truthers had rejected the official account of 9/11 on the basis of alleged or supposed anomalies. Anomalies, coming from the word nomos, refers to occurrences that are exceptions to the norms, rules, or regularities. In saying that the 9/11 truth movement speaks of supposed or alleged anomalies in the collapse of the World Trade Center, Moyers and Perry were saying that the official account, according to which the buildings were brought down by the airliners and the resulting fires, contained no real anomalies, no exceptions to the regularities of physics and chemistry, no miracles. In truth, the official account of the destruction of the World Trade Center contains many anomalies, and some of them are so obviously and violently contrary to the laws of science that they must be called miracles. Insofar as Moyers and Perry endorse the official account of the destruction of the World Trade Center, they accept all of these miracles. I will point out six of them. First.
You are listening to the voice of Dr. David Ray Griffin, author of 11 books on September 11th, and Emeritus Professor of Philosophy of Religion and Theology at the Claremont School of Theology. We've just aired the beginning of our premium today, 9/11, Why Do Bill Moyers and Robert Perry Accept Miracles? It's also known as the Gatekeeper Speech. This is a 1.5-hour DVD. It's his presentation in Seattle. There's questions and answers from the audience at the very end. And where we left off there, Dr. Griffin was just about to start going into 9/11 evidence, the empirical evidence, the forensic evidence for an inside job. This 90-minute DVD, 9/11, Why Do Bill Moyers and Robert Perry Accept Miracles, is our gift to you today for a very generous tax-deductible donation to listener-sponsored KPFA Radio of $100. $100, and we would be delighted to provide you with this professionally produced DVD, one that you heard Barbara Honecker introduce as one of his most important speeches, the thing that he wanted to do immediately when coming out of a coma. 9/11, Why Do Bill Moyers and Robert Perry Accept Miracles? Please give us a call, 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. Your tax deductible donation of $100 will be happy to provide you with this very nice thank you gift. And you know, premiums are wonderful. They're great gifts. We want everyone to have this. But of course, the real premium is this radio station. It's your ability to tune in every day of the week and listen to content here that you're not going to hear on any other radio station. You don't have to listen to commercials. This is a very expensive operation. We need your help. Please step up to the plate. Give us a call. Donate at any amount. $25 will make you a member of KPFA for a year. Donations of any amount are gladly, we're very grateful for them. $100, and we can send you this marvelous 90-minute presentation by Dr. David Ray Griffin. 1-800-439-5732. I'm joined on the phone today by Barbara Honecker. She happens to be the author of October Surprise. And Barbara, I heard Dr. Griffin mention you in your book.
Yes, he did. And the reason for that, if it wasn't obvious, is because at the time that Professor Griffin gave this magnificent presentation at Seattle Town Hall, I had already, of course, become a major leader and researcher and activist in the 9/11 Truth Movement, who specializes and still do in the Pentagon attack, even though he's now talking about, in this piece, the World Trade Center attack. And the reason that he mentioned me and my book, October Surprise, which was the first published approximately three and a half years before Robert Perry's book on October Surprise, which confirmed the October Surprise after he did his own independent research. And he courageously, to this very day, is still investigating and putting forth on his consortiumnews.com website the facts that the October Surprise actually happened, that the 1980 election was effectively stolen by the 1980 Reagan-Bush senior campaign in a secret and treasonous deal with the Ayatollah Khomeini's Iranian regime that was then holding our 52 hostages in Iran. And the reason he mentioned me in my book, October Surprise, is obviously because he is contrasting myself with Robert Perry. Because both Robert Perry and I told the truth, did the hard work, did the digging, had the courage, and still do, to tell the truth about the theft of the 1980 election by the Reagan-Bush senior campaign in the October Surprise deal with Iran. But I also tell the truth and do the hard work and go public every day of my life on the truth about 9/11 being an inside job, the absolute truth that no outside terrorist could possibly have been the true perpetrators of the attacks on the World Trade Center or the Pentagon. But Bob Perry, for truly mysterious reasons, Professor Griffin is arguing here with the facts that you're about to hear in the second excerpt, he is making the case that why is Bob Perry so good on the October Surprise, and why is he so blind on 9/11, on the forensic facts of 9/11. And this is particularly mysterious because Robert Perry, to this day, is speaking partners with none other than Ray McGovern. And Ray McGovern, as many people know, is a national hero for being a staunch anti-war activist and also telling the truth about the forensic evidence of 9/11, that the official story that we were attacked, that our country was attacked on 9/11 by outside Muslim terrorists, is a lie. It is a lie of state. Ray McGovern goes public on this, but Bob Perry, his speaking partner, refuses to accept the evidence that is hitting him between the eyes like with a 2x4.
Well, that's right, Barbara. And I think Dr. Griffin, of course, is using Robert Perry as an example because he sticks out like a sore thumb. But his overall point, of course, is this is very, very pervasive. It's not just Robert Perry. It's a lot of people. And I remember from the very beginning, as I'm sure you do as well, the leadership of the anti-war movement would have nothing to do with they would not deal with the crime of September 11th. It was verboten. And I think what's one of the things that's so very important about this presentation that Dr. Griffin is giving is he is explaining how the crime of 9/11 is what facilitates the imperial wars, the long war, the war without end, the 9/11 wars. And I have...
Yes, all of these wars are still to this day based upon the false claim of who attacked America and killed almost 3,000, mostly Americans, on 9/11, still the AUMF, the Authorization for Use of Military Force, based upon the official lie of 9/11, is still to this day used to justify all of these effective 9/11 wars in the Middle East to this very day. Now, I would like people to know that when Professor Griffin mentioned that the architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth at the time he gave this presentation in at Seattle Town Hall, where the DVD and the video was made, that you are asking pledges for today. And it's a must-see by every American. At that time, there were approximately 1,500 or 1,600 professionally licensed architects and engineers who had come out demanding a new investigation of 9/11 and put their entire credibility on the line after looking at the forensic evidence and saying that the official story of how the World Trade Centers 1, 2, and 7, World Trade Center 7, not hit by any plane, were brought down by pre-placed inside the building explosives and incendiaries. Now, today, there are approximately, there are over 1,000 more architects and engineers, fully licensed, who have put their careers and their entire credibility on the line after looking at the forensic evidence and joined with architects and engineers in their petition.
Well, that's right.
Now there are 2,600 architects and engineers.
Well, that's right, and it's growing exponentially. 1-800-439-5732. We want to get some more of you on the phone to pledge to this station, to the station that brings you the kind of content you're not going to hear on any other station. This is a real radio station. We've got a very strong signal. What's so exciting about a real radio station is that people driving along in their cars that are flipping around on the radio, they run into stuff that they wouldn't necessarily find on the internet unless they were looking for it. This is so important. Your tax-deductible donation to KPFA, listener-sponsored, non-commercial, 1-800-439-5732, a $100 donation. Of course, we would be delighted to provide you with this very important presentation by Dr. David Ray Griffin, 9/11, Why Do Bill Moyers and Robert Perry Accept Miracles? Well, Barbara, well, we've had a few people call already, so I'm very excited about that because we love this support, and this is a very important programming. You know, we've got that repeater station in Santa Cruz, and it sounds like it's really paying off. We're getting a lot of response from the South Bay. You can join these people who are generously supporting Free Speech Radio, KPFA, 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. You can pledge securely online at kpfa.org. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. You're listening to Guns and Butter. We come to you every week between 1 and 2 p.m. Oh, wow. Okay.
Show, and only if you say yes now.
Thank you. Thank you. The pledge room just walked in and gave me an anonymous match of $1,000. $1,000 is on the line.
Thank you.
Isn't that fabulous? Thank you, Anonymous. And so if we can get, if we got 10 people to pledge for Dr. Griffin's DVD, we'd make that pledge of $1,000. Thank you, Anonymous. Well, Barbara, what do you think? Let's get a few people on the phone, and then we've got another almost 10-minute clip, which I'd like to play, but we may not have enough time. We'll listen to at least some of it. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. $25 makes you a member. $100 gets you this important DVD. 1-800-439-5732. Okay, Erica, let's listen to as much of this 10-minute clip as we can.
As miracles. Why would Moyers and Perry accept the official account, even though it implies miracles? One answer might be that they, like many other journalists, have accepted the official view out of fear for their reputations. But Moyers and Perry have repeatedly shown that they have the courage to stand up for truth as they see it, regardless of the consequences. So why did Perry, who was wrongly charged with making baseless accusations about the October surprise, why did he wrongly charge truthers with making unsubstantiated and bizarre claims about controlled demolitions? As we have seen, there is nothing unsubstantiated about the claims that the Twin Towers in Building 7 were brought down by means of explosives. Perry claims that scientists and engineers have provided plausible explanations for the official view. But only a handful of scientists and engineers have stated in print that they see nothing wrong with the official view, and most of them have been dependent upon the government. Remember here Upton Sinclair's famous dictum, It is difficult to get a man to understand something when his salary depends upon his not understanding it. By contrast, thousands of professionals, including architects, engineers, firefighters, intelligence officers, military officers, and scientists, have publicly stated that the official view cannot be true. I mentioned firefighters. 118 of the 500 members of the New York Fire Department were asked to give oral histories, to give their reports of what they experienced that day. They were not asked questions. They were just told, tell us what you experienced that day. No leading questions. 118 of them volunteered the information that they experienced what seemed to be explosives in the buildings. Perry has unfairly been called a nut because of his persistence in laying out the evidence for the October surprise. Why did he, on the basis of inadequate study, turn around and say to label the truther version of the 9/11 events nutty would seem an understatement? Moyers has done equally poor reporting about 9/11, observing that America seems more and more unable to deal with reality. Moyers rightly said in his 211 lecture that many people inhabit a closed belief system on whose door they have hung the do not disturb sign. But Moyer's own belief system has evidently made him unable to deal with the reality revealed by the 9/11 truth movement. Moyer's bias against 9/11 truth was manifested 3 years before his 2011 statement. On February 1, 2008, in preparation for the presidential election, the Bill Moyers Journal asked viewers, what one book do you want your next president to read? The next week, Moyers named the three books receiving the most votes, while adding, we detected only one organized campaign against a certain book, and we disqualified it as a result. The book in question, viewers learned the following week, was my 2007 book, Debunking 9/11 Debunking, which was the book that actually received the most votes by far. Was the alleged organized campaign the real reason why this book was disqualified? It would seem not, for three reasons. First, Moyers had not, in explaining the contest, said anything about disallowing organized campaigns. In the second place, the so-called organized campaign consisted entirely of one person writing a statement on 9/11 Blogger, saying that he suspected most members of the 9/11 Truth Movement would be recommending one of Griffin's books. He suggested that they agree on one of them, and he suggested the most recent book, Debunking 9/11 Debunking. I myself played no role in this campaign. Indeed, I did not even know about the contest until it was long over. In the third place, one of the book authors, Kim Michaels, organized a campaign on behalf of his own book, The Art of Non-War. On his website, he wrote, Bill Moyers is asking viewers to recommend the one book that the next president of the United States should take to the White House. If you feel so inclined, please recommend The Art of Non-War. As a result, Michael's book came in third in the voting, a fact that was used by the publisher to promote the book. However, the Bill Moyers Journal did not eliminate Michael's book from the competition in spite of his self-organized campaign. In justifying the exclusion of my book because of signs of an orchestrated campaign, Moyers said, I wouldn't call it a conspiracy, but I wouldn't call it fair either. But if unfairness was the reason why my book was excluded, the Michaels book, the campaign for which could have easily been detected, should have been excluded. It would seem, therefore, that my book was excluded because Bill Moyers did not want to announce that his program had recommended my book with its claim that 9/11 was an inside job. By taking Moyers' treatment of my book in 2008, together with his 2011 attack on truthers, we can see that he, like Perry, has made charges against the 9/11 truth movement that are not justified by the empirical evidence. I have yet another question for Moyers and Perry. Given their negative characterization of people they call truthers, such as Moyers' statement that they employ sophistry and Perry's charge that they have preposterous notions, one would assume that none of their esteemed friends would have anything good to say about such people. But one of Moyers' most esteemed friends was William Sloan Coffin, who after leaving the CIA became famous as a preacher, an anti-Vietnam War activist, and a leader of the civil rights movement. Moyers interviewed Coffin in 2004 and then spoke at his funeral in 2006. Shortly before his death, Coffin wrote, "All Americans who love their country enough to dig into the facts of these critical times will be well rewarded by examining Professor Griffin's books. 9/11 truth is a very important issue with the power to bring lasting change to our country."
That's the voice of Dr. David Ray Griffin, a part of his presentation, 9/11, Why Do Bill Moyers and Robert Perry Accept Miracles, also known as the Gatekeeper Speech. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. We have like only maybe 12 minutes to go, and we have a $1,000 match that we need to make by a very generous anonymous donor, 1-800-439-5732. A $100 tax-deductible donation to commercial-free, listener-sponsored KPFA, and we would be more than delighted to provide you with this wonderful thank you gift, this 90-minute DVD, Why Do Bill Moyers and Robert Perry Accept Miracles? It sounds like Barbara Honecker's having a little static there. Is that what that was?
No, it wasn't, Bonnie.
Oh, okay. Sorry. That was something else. Sorry.
I thought it was you.
Oh, I was worried about you there, Barb. I just want
to
let...
I would like to make a comment if I could.
Oh, yes. Please go ahead, Barb.
Right. Well, you've just heard snippets of a magnificent DVD, a video that everyone needs to see. And also, I want to give some good news. And the good news is that after 15 years, the anti-war movement, which has foolishly made 9/11, the forensic facts of 9/11, of who really attacked our country on 9/11, literally a taboo subject, even though it is literally the root of the evil tree of all of the 9/11 wars that they claim to be against. The progressive movement in this country holds an annual meeting called the Left Forum. And for 15 years since the attacks of 9/11, we're approaching the 15th anniversary here in 2016, in this September, for almost 15 years, the Left Forum, which is the largest gathering of progressives in the country annually, for the first time in 15 years, they have finally accepted, they did finally accept an explicit 9/11 truth panel at the 2016 Left Forum a few months ago. And there were two speakers who were invited to speak explicitly on 9/11 truth. I was one of them, and the other is Professor Kevin Barrett. Professor Kevin Barrett and myself finally broke through what, I don't know what you'd call it, the is it the glass ceiling or the lead ceiling of the progressive anti-war movement taboo for almost 15 years to even allow discussion of the facts of 9/11, and we broke through. So, Bonnie, I'm going to send you the link to that wonderful online presentation of the 2016 Left Forum of myself and Professor Kevin Barrett. And that is the good news, that we seem to now finally, after almost 15 years, have movement in the anti-war movement towards recognizing the true root of the 9/11 war.
Well, thank you very much, Barbara. I'll try and have Tony post that on the Guns and Butter website. I think you're more of an optimist than I. I'm not holding my breath. It has been 15 years, but nevertheless, that is good news. Now,
well, maybe that's the sound we heard, you holding your breath and finally releasing it.
But we have very important business to take care of now. We've only got 8.5 minutes left. We've got a very generous match of $1,000. We need a few more people to call in with $100 tax-deductible donations to keep this kind of programming on the air, to keep KPFA healthy and up and running. This is so important. 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, a $100 tax-deductible donation. We can send you this wonderful DVD of Dr. David Ray Griffin up in Seattle. He also takes his Q&A from the audience. It's very important. Why is this subject so taboo? Because, as he points out, this is the underpinning. The crimes of 9/11 facilitate all of the imperial wars. And I would like to quote, and I've done this before, but it's such a wonderful quote from economist Michel Chosedowski, who said on Guns and Butter, shortly after 9/11, he was talking about the leadership of the anti-war movement in this country, their rejection of dealing with the crimes of 9/11. He was bemoaning that, and I'll never forget, he said, it's not enough to be against war. Everyone is against war. It's necessary to expose the big lie that the war is based on. And that's a quote from Michel Chosedowski. I always like to repeat that. I think that really nails it. 1-800-439-5732. Please call in. A donation of $25 makes you a KPFA member for a year. That's very important. 1-800-439-5732. So if we could get some more people calling in, $25, $50, whatever you can afford, it's a good cause. This is a real radio station. We must keep it healthy. 1-800-439-5732. We've got a few more minutes. Barbara, any last thoughts on our great thank you gift or why people should pledge to KPFA?
Oh, absolutely, Bonnie. I just want to remind people who already know it and let your listeners know, if they don't know it, how important Bonnie's Guns and Butter and KPFA is to support. And probably the best proof of that is that it was Bonnie's program on Guns and Butter, on KPFA, interviewing Professor Griffin himself, that happened to be being listened to by none other than architect Richard Gage, San Francisco Bay Area architect and Richard Gage. He was so stunned by the forensic evidence of what he was hearing on Bonnie's own program that he had to pull to the side of the freeway to continue listening to the program, and committed then and there to dedicating his life to 9/11 truth. That's how important KPFA and Guns and Butter is. Please, please pledge.
Well, we made the match. Thank you, Barbara. Thank you for all your help. Thank you to listeners. And I've got a few more people to thank. And, you know, Barbara, that's very nice of you to bring up the fact that Richard Gage actually heard David Ray Griffin on Guns and Butter. It was the show that we did called It was after the New York Times had sued, after there was a suit brought by the New York Times for the fire department to make public their interviews with the firemen, with the witnesses of 9/11. And yes. Those were the witnesses of the demolition rings, the explosions in the towers. And when Richard Gage heard that, he told me later, he pulled over, like you said, and thought to himself, can this be true? He didn't have an idea. You know, so many people, and still are so blinded by the Western propaganda machine that it's hard to see through. It's hard for people to accept this. And I'm glad you brought that up, Barbara, because Yara Mako once said to me, Bonnie, if we've done nothing other than launch Richard Gage, it's all been worth it. I've got a couple of minutes. Oh, I want to thank some people here for helping us make our match. 1-800-439-5732. People have called in to generously support KPFA, to support the programming we bring you here. We want to keep this station healthy. It's so very important. 1-800-439-5732. I'm so excited we made that match. That's great. $1,000 match.
Fantastic. Thank you.
That's a big one. Also, we're going to have to get off in a few seconds, but we're going to have our annual 9/11 Film Festival at the Grand Lake Theater again this year, of course. It's going to be on September 8th. That's a Thursday. It's going to be from 1 to 10 p.m. Our keynote speaker is going to be Graham McQueen. I'm very excited about that, and I'm going to have him on the show on the Wednesday before the 9/11 Film Festival, so look forward to that. And we are running our five-part with Kevin Ryan on 9/11 leading up to the anniversary of September 11th. Thank you so much. Shoot me an email at faulkner@gunsandbutter.org. Go to the website, gunsandbutter.org. Barbara Honecker, thank you so much. We did it.
We did it. Congratulations.
Thank you, Barb. Something happening, yeah. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap. next.
New World Notes.
Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, part two of Dr. Robert Lustig on why our diet is killing us. It's not the fat, it's the sugar, and it's one sugar in particular, fructose. I hope you'll stay tuned. We return to a bold speech by Dr. Robert Lustig, physician and medical researcher at the University of California, San Francisco. His claim, there is one clear villain that is causing America's current epidemic of heart disease, hypertension, high cholesterol, type 2 diabetes, some types of liver disease, obesity, metabolic syndrome, and general fatness. That cause is the huge and still growing amount of sugar we eat. Yes, what's clogging your arteries with cholesterol is not the fat in that Big Mac you just ate. It's the sugar in the 40-ounce Coke you washed it down with, plus the sugar in the bun, the pickle, the ketchup, the mustard, not to mention our own special sauce. Not all sugars are bad, Lustig states. Glucose is okay. The villain is fructose, as in high fructose corn syrup. But old-fashioned cane sugar, sucrose, is just as bad. The body breaks down sucrose and turns much of it into fructose. Fructose is dirt cheap to manufacture. The food industry is adding the stuff hand over fist to practically every processed food. And the food industry is removing nature's own antidote to fructose, which is fiber. A part of Lustig's original lecture is a long explanation of the biochemistry of fructose metabolism. Exactly how fructose damages your liver, blood vessels, pancreas, you name it. A lot of this is interesting stuff, but the details would fill a full program in itself. So I'm going to skip over most of the biochemistry details, and a few other things besides. As we pick up, Lustig talks about three things that happened in the 1970s that set off our skyrocketing consumption of fructose. The first is President Richard Nixon.
He admonished his Secretary of Agriculture, Earl Rusty Butz, I love that name, to basically take food off the political table, to make food a non-issue in presidential elections. Well, the only way to do that was to make food cheap. So he was out to find all methods to be able to decrease the price of food. Remember Nixon's war on poverty? We're suffering from it today. Second political wind, the advent of high fructose corn syrup. Okay? So this was invented in 1966 at Saga Medical School in Japan by a guy named Takasaki, who's still alive. As far as I'm concerned, this stuff is Japan's revenge for World War II. Except, of course, that they're suffering from it now themselves. Okay? Like everything, you know, it always comes back to haunt you. And it was introduced to the American market in 1975. So what do you think happened to the price of sugar when this thing hit the market? Up and down. Here's where corn sweeteners entered the market, 1975, 1980, and you can see that since then, the price of sugar has remained remarkably constant. And it did so not just in the U.S., but also on the international stage. Here's the London price doing the same thing. And when you look at the difference in price between sugar and high fructose corn syrup, you can see that high fructose corn syrup is about half the price. So in other words, it's cheap. So high fructose corn syrup is evil, but it's not evil because it's metabolically evil. It's evil because it's economically evil, because it's so cheap that it's found its way into everything. It's found its way into hamburger buns, pretzels, barbecue sauce, and ketchup. Somebody emailed me the other day and told me they went into their local grocery store and went through every single loaf of bread on the shelf. And out of 32 types of bread on the shelf, only one of them did not have high fructose corn syrup in it. So we are being poisoned by this stuff, and it's been added surreptitiously to all of our food, every processed food. Okay? And the question is, why? The corn refiners like to point out, well, you know, it's just been a substitution. As the high fructose corn syrup's gone up, the sugar's gone down. You know, we're just replacing, you know, like gram for gram. Well, not exactly, because here's 73 pounds of sugar per year. This is from the Economic Research Service of the U.S. Department of Agriculture, disappearance data. 73 pounds up to 95 pounds by 2000. And there's something missing from this slide. Juice is missing, because juice is sucrose, right? Okay. So this is a study done by Miles Faith, a prospective study in inner city Harlem toddlers. And the number of juice servings per day predicts the change in BMI score per month in these inner city Harlem toddlers. Now, where do these inner city Harlem toddlers get their juice? From where? From whom? From WIC. You know what WIC is? Women, Infants, Children, right? A government entitlement program set up under who? Nixon, okay, to prevent failure to thrive. They did. This is the equal and opposite reaction. So let's add juice in. Here it is. And so most fructose items, when you put it together, now we're up to 113 pounds on this graph. And I just heard from Brian Williams of NBC News after the most recent study came out that was in the Journal of Clinical Investigation that we are actually up to 141 pounds of sugar per year, each of us. That's what we're up to, 141 pounds of sugar per year. Now, do you think that this might have some detrimental effects on you? Hasn't stopped you, has it? That's the point. It hasn't stopped you. That's why we need to talk about this. So, juice consumption increases the risk for type 2 diabetes, okay? So this is the relative risk ratio as juice intake goes up, and this is in the nurse's study, okay? Showing, again, juice consumption, sucrose, obesity, diabetes. The third political storm, okay, that was swirling around to create this disaster, this mega typhoon that happened in 1982. The USDA, the American Heart Association, the American Medical Association, all telling us we had to reduce our consumption of fat. Now, why did they tell us that? To stop heart disease, did we? No, we didn't. In fact, it's worked the exact opposite. We've only created more. So now, how did this come to be? Why did they tell us to stop eating fat? Well, in the early 1970s, we discovered something in our blood called LDL, low-density lipoproteins. You've heard of that, right? Is it good or bad? Not so bad. We'll talk about it. In the mid-1970s, we learned that dietary fat raised your LDL. So if dietary fat is A and LDL is B, we learned that A led to B. Okay, dietary fat definitely increases your LDL. No argument. It's true. Okay? And then, finally, in the late 1970s, we learned that LDL correlated with cardiovascular disease. Okay? So let's call cardiovascular disease C. So we learned that B led to C. So the thought process by some very smart nutritionists, et cetera, you know, the USDA, et cetera, said, well, if A leads to B and B leads to C, then A must lead to C. Therefore, no A, no C. This was the logic. Now, any logicians in the room? Anybody see any problems with that logic? That's right. The premise is incorrect because this suggests that this is all transitive, but in fact, only the contrapositive is transitive. So it's not no A, no C. It's no C, no A. There's faulty logic here. But before I show you why it doesn't work, I'm going to show you that this was a battle royal back in the 1970s. This was not a simple thing. There were people lined up on both sides of this story. So this, over here, is a book, 1972 it came out, and it was called Pure, White, and Deadly. It's all about sugar, written by a British physiologist, nutritionist, endocrinologist by the name of John Yudkin. Now, I never knew John Yudkin. He's passed away. But I read this book about a year ago, and without even knowing it, I was a Yudkin acolyte. I was a Yudkin disciple. Every single thing that this man said in 1972 is the God's honest truth. And if you want to read a true prophecy, you find this book. It's not easy to find, but you go find this book, and I'm telling you, every single thing this guy said has come to pass. It's astounding. I am in awe of this guy. But on the other side, we had this guy over here. Okay, his name was Ansel Keys. Anybody heard of him? Okay. So Ansel Keys was a Minnesota epidemiologist, very interested in the cause of cardiovascular disease, and he performed the first multivariate regression analysis without computers. Now, anybody know what that means? Multivariate regression analysis? Okay, so this is where you take a whole lot of data, okay, and normally you would just, you know, run a few computer programs, but basically the object is to try to figure out what causes what, and to try to factor out other things and determine what the contribution of various things all at once are to an outcome that you're looking for. So he was interested in cardiovascular disease, and so what he did was he did this study along with other people around the world called the Seven Countries Study, very famous, front page of Time magazine in 1980. So here's the data on the Seven Countries Study. We have the U.S., we have Canada, Australia, England, Wales, Italy, Japan. Okay, and here's percent calories from fat on the x-axis, and here we have coronary disease death rate on the y-axis. And so you'd say, well, look at that. I mean, it's very obvious, isn't it? Sure, percent calories from fat correlates very nicely with coronary disease, except for one little problem, Japan and Italy. So how much sugar do they eat? Didn't I tell you the Japanese diet eliminates fructose? They never even had it till we brought it to them after World War II. Italy, you know, aside from gelato, I mean, what else they got? Okay? They got a lot of pasta. There's a lot of glucose, but no fructose. Okay? There's no sugar in the Italian diet other than the occasional sweet, which they moderate. They're very careful about moderating, and they cost a lot. But here we got England, Wales, Canada, Australia, U.S. You know, we are sugarholics, aren't we? We're also fataholics. So, in fact, the fat migrated with the sugar. So this is from Keyes' own work. Okay, page 262, if you want to pick up the 500-page volume. And I'm just going to read you the one paragraph, okay, that talks about this. The fact that the incidence rate of coronary heart disease was significantly correlated with the average percentage of calories from sucrose in the diet is explained by the intercorrelation of sucrose with saturated fat. In other words, donuts. Wherever there was the fat, there was sucrose too. Because these guys here eat donuts. Partial correlation analysis show that with saturated fat constant, there was no significant correlation between dietary sucrose and the incidence of coronary heart disease. Okay. When you do a multivariate linear regression analysis, you have to do it both ways. You have to do holding fat constant, showing that sucrose doesn't work, and then you have to hold sucrose constant and show that fat still works. You see that anywhere? He didn't do it. He didn't do the thing that you need to do a multivariate linear regression analysis. Now, this was done before computers. We can't check the work. He's dead. He died in 2004. So we're left with a conundrum. Do we believe this? Do we believe this study? Because we based 30 years of nutrition, education, and information and policy in this country on this study. And as far as I'm concerned, it has a hole as big as the one in the USS Cole. Remember I told you LDL, maybe not so bad? Well, here's why. Because there really isn't one LDL. There are two. Here's one over here. It's called pattern A, or a large buoyant LDL. So everybody knows that LDL correlates with cardiovascular disease, and that's true. And I'm not going to argue that. That is true. But it's not this one. Pattern A LDL. These guys are so light, they are buoyant, they float. So they get carried through the bloodstream, and they don't even have a chance because they're so big and they're so buoyant, they don't even get underneath the edge of the endothelial cells in the vasculature to start the plaque formation process. But over here we have this other guy over here called pattern B, or small dense LDL. You see the difference? These guys are dense. These guys don't float. These guys are small. They get underneath the edge of the surface of the endothelial cells, and they start the plaque formation. And it's been shown by numerous investigators now that small, dense LDL is the bad guy. Okay, now, when we measure LDL in the bloodstream, when you do a lipid profile, you measure both of them together because it's too hard to distinguish the two. So when you get an LDL, you're getting both LDLs, the neutral one and the bad one. Now, how can you tell whether your LDL is the neutral one or the bad one? What you do is you look at your triglyceride level in association with it, because your triglycerides tell you which one it is. So here's pattern A over here, okay? Big, large, buoyant LDLs, okay? And you'll notice that the triglycerides are low and your HDL is high. That's what you want. You want a low triglyceride, high HDL, because that's the good cholesterol. You want good cholesterol. Over here you have pattern B, and here you have high triglyceride, low HDL. That's the bad guy. That's the guy you don't want to be, because you're going to die of a heart attack. No question about it. Triglyceride to HDL ratio actually predicts cardiovascular disease way better than LDL ever did. Point is, when you measure LDL, you measure both. So, dietary fat raises your large buoyant. What do you think raises your small dense? Carbohydrate. Okay, so here's percent carbohydrate, and here's your pattern B going up. Everybody got it? What did we do in 1982? We went on a high-carb diet, which was supposed to be a low-fat diet, right? So here's the low-fat craze. Took America and the world by storm because the content of low-fat home-cooked food that you cook by yourself in your house, you can control the content of fat. But when you low-fat processed food, it tastes like cardboard. The food companies knew that, so what did they do? They had to make it palatable. So how do you make it something palatable that has no fat in it? You add the sugar. So everybody remember Snackwells? Okay, so 2 grams of fat down, 13 grams of carbohydrate up, 4 of them being sugars so that it was palatable. Well, we've just shown you that that's the worst thing you could do. And that's what we've done. And we're still doing it today. So when you find a mistake, what do? You admit the mistake and you right the ship. We haven't admitted the mistake and we haven't righted the ship. So we've had our food supply adulterated, contaminated, poisoned, tainted, on purpose. And we've allowed it through the addition of fructose for palatability, especially because of the decreased fat, and also as a ostensibly browning agent, which actually has its own issues, because why it browns so well with the sugar in it actually is what's going on in your arteries, because that's causing what we call protein glycation and cross-linking, which is actually contributing to atherosclerosis. So it works on your steak on the grill. It works in your arteries the same way. And removal of fiber also. Now, why did we remove fiber from our diet? We as human beings walking the earth 50,000 years ago used to consume 100 to 300 grams of fiber per day. We now consume 12. What did we do? So why did we take the fiber out? Well, it takes too long to cook, takes too long to eat, and shelf life. So people ask me, what's the definition of fast food? Fiberless food. Okay? I dare you, other than a salad, I dare you to go to any fast food restaurant and find anything on their menu that they actually have to cook that has more than 1 gram of fiber in it, because there isn't any. And that's on purpose, because they take the fiber out, because that way they can freeze it, ship it around the world, and cook it up fast. And not only is it fast cooking, but it's fast eating, which also causes its own satiety issues. Bottom line, we have a typhoon on our hands. Okay? And then finally, the last issue was the substitution of trans fats, which are clearly a disaster. But those have been going down because we know that those are a problem. So we've gotten rid of most trans fats. Not completely, but most. So this is it. This is what we've done over the last 30 years. Now to the biochemistry. And let me show you why fructose is not glucose. Okay? Because what the liver does to fructose is really unique. And you've got to understand it to understand everything I've just told you. So number one, fructose is 7 times more likely than glucose to do that browning reaction, the advanced glycosylation end products. The thing that happens on your grill happens in your arteries for the same reason. Okay? You can actually see the color, too, color change, too. Fructose does not suppress the hunger hormone. There's a hormone that comes from your stomach called ghrelin you've heard about already. Okay? So if you preload a kid with a can of soda, and then you let them loose at the fast food restaurant, do they eat more or do they eat less? They eat more. They just took on 150 calories, yet they eat more. Reason? Because fructose doesn't suppress the hunger hormone ghrelin. So they eat more. Acute fructose ingestion does not stimulate insulin because there's no receptor for fructose, no transporter for fructose on the beta cell that makes insulin. So the insulin doesn't go up. Well, if the insulin doesn't go up, then leptin doesn't go up. And if leptin doesn't go up, your brain doesn't see that you ate something. Therefore, you eat more. And finally, I'm going to show you liver hepatic fructose metabolism is completely different between fructose and glucose. Completely different. And I'm going to show you before the day is out, the evening's out, that chronic fructose exposure alone, nothing else, causes this thing we call the metabolic syndrome. Everybody knows what the metabolic syndrome is? Okay, so this is the conglomerate of the following different phenomena: obesity, type 2 diabetes, lipid problems, hypertension, and cardiovascular disease. Those all cluster together, called metabolic syndrome. I'm going to show you how fructose does every one of those. So here are the phenomena associated with chronic ethanol exposure: hematologic disorders, electrolyte abnormalities, hypertension, cardiac dilatation, cardiomyopathy, dyslipidemia, pancreatitis, malnutrition, obesity, hepatic dysfunction, that's alcoholic steatohepatitis, fetal alcohol syndrome, and addiction. Here's fructose, 8 out of 12. Why? Because they do the same thing. Because they're metabolized the same way. Because they are the same. They come from the same place, right? How do you make ethanol? Naturally. Right. You ferment sugar. Hasn't changed. Because it has all the same properties. Because it's basically taken care of by the liver in exactly the same way. And for the same reason. Because sugar and ethanol are the same. Every which way you turn. So here's our clinic intervention. This is what we do in our clinic. Okay? It's as simple as you can imagine. We write this on the back of a matchbook. Okay? I mean, it's just as simple as you can make it. We have four things we teach the kids to do and the parents. Get rid of every sugared liquid in the house, bar none. Only water and milk. Okay? There is no such thing as a good sugar beverage, period. Eat your carbohydrate with fiber. Why? Because fiber is good. Fiber is supposed to be an essential nutrient. And we can talk later, if you want, after the cameras turn off, as to why fiber is not an essential nutrient. Because the government doesn't want it to be. Because then they couldn't sell food abroad. Wait 20 minutes for second portions, okay, to get that satiety signal. And finally, buy your screen time minute for minute with physical activity. That's the hardest one to do. Okay, so if you play for half an hour, you can watch TV for half an hour. You want to watch TV for an hour, play for an hour. That one's a hard one. But anyway, we follow our patients every 3 months. So here's my question. Does it work? Yeah, it works. So this is BMI Z-score, time from initial visit. It works. But we were interested in what made it work and what made it didn't work. So we did a multivariate linear regression analysis, right? The thing that made it not work, sugared beverage consumption. The more sugar beverages the patients drank at baseline, the less well the lifestyle intervention worked, for all the reasons I just showed you. So why is exercise important in obesity? Because it burns calories? Come on. 20 minutes of jogging is one chocolate chip cookie. You can't do it. Are you joking me? So why is exercise important? Number one, it improves that skeletal muscle insulin sensitivity because your insulin actually works better at your muscle, okay, which then brings your insulin levels down, which is good for you. Number two, it's your endogenous stress reducer. It's the single thing that actually stress reduces. And if you stress reduce, what do you think your appetite does? Goes down. Because stress and obesity go hand in hand, right? For all sorts of reasons which are beyond the scope of this lecture today, but we can talk about in the question period if you want. And then finally, remember that de novo lipogenesis? Remember those three nasty enzymes? Okay. What if you burned the stuff off before you made the fat? That's what exercise does, because it makes that TCA cycle run faster, so you don't get the citrate leaving the mitochondria, so it doesn't get turned into fat, so it doesn't precipitate and cause all the problems you just saw. That's what they mean by a higher metabolism, yes. Okay? But it has nothing to do with burning of calories. That is the stupidest reason that I've ever heard of for exercise. You got to be joking me. Okay? You can't do it. I mean, one Big Mac, you know, and you got to, you know, mountain bike for 10 hours. Are you joking? Okay, so why is fiber important in obesity? So this is my motto in clinic. When God made the poison, he packaged it with the antidote. Okay, because fructose is a poison. I think I've hopefully shown you that. Okay, but wherever there's fructose in nature, there's way more fiber. Do you ever see a piece of sugar cane? It's a stick. Right? You can't even chew the damn thing, right? You got to suck the stuff out like that, right? I mean, how many calories do you think you're going to get out of a piece of sugar cane? They actually did studies on the sugar plantations back in the early 1900s. Okay, all of the workers were healthy and lived longer than the sugar executives who got the processed product. How about that? Wonder why. Okay, so Eat your carbohydrate with fiber. That's why we say that. That includes sugar. That's why fruit's okay. Because number one, it limits how much fructose you're going to take in. And number two, it gives you an essential nutrient, which you needed in the first place. And you get some micronutrients along with it so that you actually can, your liver works healthier. So, in summary, fructose, and I don't care what the vehicle is, it's irrelevant. Sucrose or high fructose corn syrup, I don't care. Fructose consumption has increased in the past 30 years, coinciding with the obesity epidemic. A calorie is not a calorie. Okay? And the dietitians in this country are actually perpetrating this on us. Because the more you think a calorie is a calorie, the more you think, well, then if you ate less and exercised more, it would work. It doesn't. All of the studies show it doesn't work. Here's why it doesn't work. Because a calorie is not a calorie. Fructose is not glucose. We know a calorie is not a calorie because there are good fats and bad fats. There's good protein and bad protein. Okay, there's good carbohydrate and bad carbohydrate. And glucose is good carbohydrate. Glucose is the energy of life. Fructose, okay, is poison. You are not what you eat. You are what you do with what you eat. And what you do with fructose is particularly egregious and dangerous. Hepatic fructose metabolism leads to all the manifestations of the metabolic syndrome. Hypertension through that uric acid pathway, de novo lipogenesis, dyslipidemia, hepatic steatosis through that DNL pathway, those three enzymes, the new fat-making pathway, inflammation through JNK1, hepatic insulin resistance because of the serine phosphorylation of IRS1, obesity because of the VLDL transport to the adipocyte, and leptin resistance promoting continuous consumption, basically starving your brain, making you think you need more. Fructose ingestion interferes with obesity intervention, as we showed in our clinic. The more soft drinks, the less well diet and exercise actually worked. Fructose is a chronic hepatotoxin for the same reason that alcohol is. The only difference is alcohol is metabolized by the brain, so you get alcohol effects. Fructose is not metabolized by the brain, so you don't get those effects, but everything else it does is the same. But the FDA can't and won't regulate it. It's up to us. I'm Robert Lustig, and I'm here to recruit you in the war against bad food. Okay? And this is what's bad.
Dr. Robert Lustig, concluding Sugar, the Bitter Truth. Robin Upton of UnwelcomeGuests.net nicely adapted this long lecture to radio, and I have cut it down still further. Thanks again to Robin. And thank you for listening to New World Notes. Find our nearly complete archive of past shows on the web at newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, once again suggesting illegitimi non carborundum. Try to live each day as though the truth were true. Please come back again next week and keep in mind that you are not alone. Ciao.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 wake up call.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Today you'll hear a replay of Michael Parenti's speech given in May of 2010 at the Understanding Deep Politics Conference in Santa Cruz, California. He's talking about conspiracies. Michael Parenti is an internationally known, award-winning author and lecturer. He is one of the nation's leading progressive political analysts. His highly informative and entertaining books and talks have reached a wide range of audiences in North America and abroad. And three of his most recent books that he's written are God and His Demons, Contrary Notions, A Michael Parenti Reader, and The Assassination of Julius Caesar. And here he is speaking at the Understanding Deep Politics Conference in Santa Cruz on May 15th, 2010.
Thank you. It's nice to be here. I'm actually going to give a talk about deep ideology and conspiracy is really what I'm going to be talking about. And there's another talk I gave about conspiracy. They just rediscovered it. It had been lost for some years, and they found the tape of it. Some student had actually taped it. It's not such bad shape, and it's available on TUC Radio, and that's called Conspiracy and Class Power. And that talk is probably more coherent and intelligent than this one will be because I was younger and more capable then. It's about 12 years old or so. I just heard it the other night. I said, hey, whoa, that's pretty good. And I thought I'd try to smuggle it in here. But, you know, it's better to really think anew and think about some other things again. But what do I mean by deep ideology? Well, I mean I want to try and fit it into the theme of this conference. But it is questionable because ideology is usually something that is out there. It's vigorously propagated. You know, you talk of the conservative ideology has talked about the free market. They talked about how government can't solve the problem. Government is the problem. We're overregulated. We're overtaxed. There's a downward distribution to the less worthy. And now money is wasted by government bureaucrats and the like. But behind this explicit ideological cell, I just gave you a sketch of what the right-wing dicta are on that. Behind that explicit ideological cell is an implicit ideological goal and rationale. A rationale that's really around very real interests. In 1978, I came across a quote by somebody from the Business Council. His name wasn't given, but he was saying things like, what's going on? The income gap between the highest and lowest is more narrow than it's ever been. Human services are increasing. If we will end up as a social democracy if we don't watch it, he said. Now, I found that very fascinating because I think there's only about 600 people in all of America who know what the hell social democracy means or even use the term. I mean, the term is simply not used in America, and that's a victory right there. The ability to keep certain words out of political discourse, like social democracy, is a very real right-wing victory. The ability to inject certain words like conspiracy theory, which puts a closure on any kind of thinking about something, that also is a tremendous victory. So this struggle, this battle over words, is something to be taken very seriously. And if anybody asks me tomorrow on that panel, what will you do? I'll say struggle and battle over words. This was in 1978, when this guy from the Business Council made that statement that we're heading for social democracy. What he meant is we're going to become another Denmark or Sweden or Norway, where people will have health care, where the standard of living is going to be very good and high, where there's going to be a real pressure on the super rich, where CEOs will not be able to make hundreds of millions of dollars every year. They're going to have to get along on just a few million a year. You know, how the hell can a guy like that live on a few million a year? So they don't want that. And 78 was a very significant year because that Business Council delivered the word to President Jimmy Carter. And we got Reaganism, and we got Reagan 2 years before Reagan. He didn't come into office till January 81. And in 78, end of 78, Carter was acting like Reagan. He started cutting back on human services. He called for increase in the military budget. He was moving in a rightward direction. But Carter couldn't really do the thing that they wanted, which was a massive rollback. Carter was still beholden to the labor unions, to black voters, to progressives, liberals, and those people. And so they went with Reagan. Now, fast forward 30 years. You have had in that 30 years an ideological war that these guys have waged. They understand something that the liberals still don't understand. They understand something in the Republican Party that the Democrats still haven't been able to grasp, because the Democrats are too busy saying, we don't disagree that much. We really can work together. We can be bipartisan. They understand that ideas count, that ideology counts, that the words you use count, that those words control those ideas, and those ideas control those people. And they have been hammering home for those 30 years. So you go 30 years forward to the year 2008, and David Frum, GOP strategist, quote, the core task that the Republican Party has had was to stop and reverse to some degree the drift of democratic countries after the Second World War towards social democracy. And that is what we did in the U.S. We stopped the drift toward, and there's those two words that jumped right back up out of the page at me. It was in the New Yorker magazine. Social democracy. We got to stop the drift towards social democracy. These guys know about social democracy, and they know they have a conscious agenda to prevent it from happening. And they know that their opponents aren't even paying attention to this. The average Democratic politician, from Pat Leahy to Schumer to the others, with the possible exception of Howard Dean, who does know how to organize nationally and is totally ignored by the Democratic National Council. The others are all worrying about getting reelected themselves and putting in their little plea and talking about this or that issue. Well, what was Frum saying? He was saying, we've won the battle. We have so rolled back the social democracy that we've run out of issues. Furthermore, we've moved successfully so far right, we've moved beyond our base. And he noticed in the 2006 election, what? The Republicans lost Congress. And where did they lose Congress? They lost it in the goddamn Republican suburbs that always voted for them. Those people started waking up. Those people were saying, hey, they've been jacking us up the kazoo for all these years, and it's getting a little too bad. What are we getting out of this? I think I'm going to go back and start voting Democratic again. And domestic issues showed, and the polls showed, that the general public was on the liberal side of most of these issues. They were for human services. They were for keeping and developing Social Security. They were for health care and education and environmental protections and taxing the super rich. But as I said, the liberals never really mobilized that, never really built a narrative and a deep ideology and a public ideology around those issues, because some of these liberals are too busy not being liberals and being conservatives. Oh, we got a president who's like that. He's happiest when he can say, I'm for nuclear power, and we're going to drill offshore because America's going to be self-sustaining. Remember, he talked about he was a drill baby drill without the baby, but there he was. Those 40 years or so, the conservatives not only fashioned a mainline ideology, they built a net of media commentators, publications, networks, as I said, media networks, think tanks, professional and academic associations of their own, training centers that would channel and recruit and channel cadres of young conservative activists into law schools and from law schools into clerking for judgeships and the like, teachers, writers who promoted conservative ideas and policies. So there has been this structure of organizations that has orchestrated and propagated a mass line ideology that has been guided by a deep ideology, that is the deep ideology that serves the interests of the owning corporate class. Sometimes it peeks through in the mass line ideology when there are denunciations of socialism and when equating government regulations with totalitarianism and progressive income tax is equated, and inheritance tax on the rich is equated with confiscation and communist theft. You know, the right over the last 40 years or more has been really pushing this line. Now, what I'm saying here is that this is a conscious, intentionally disguised agenda by people who know what social democracy is and say to you explicitly in English, your mother tongue, they say, we want to destroy social democracy. We don't want that in this country or any country. So they've got this, and they mobilize broad constituencies on behalf of the interests of the few. And that's the point to remember. A book I wrote on this called Democracy for the Few, now just come out in its ninth edition. Don't buy it. It's horrible. They sell it as a textbook for $70, $80, despite protests of the author. That's not what the book was intended to be, a book only for royalty or oppressed students, you know. But for the few, you see, the very few at the top, and that's an idea that is at the heart of their raison d'être. That's an idea that they dare not utter to anybody. You'll never hear them saying that on the air. You'll never hear Glenn Beck or Rush Limbaugh saying, all of this is for the interests of the very super rich. Everything I do, everyone I serve is for that. Epauchi is what they were called in ancient Rome, in the late Republic. And the term used quite often by one of them who was a member of the Epauchi. I wrote a book called The Assassination of Julius Caesar and dealt with this. They were called the Optimati. They were the inner core of the Roman Senate. The Roman Senate had 500 members, but there were these 15, 20, 30 who really, really owned much of Rome. And Epauchi was the term used by Cicero, who many people would consider one of them. He really wasn't. He didn't have the right blood, but he was their faithful servant and their faithful spokesperson. Pauci in Latin means few. He was saying, the few. This is for the few, you know. And sometimes he would be a little sarcastic about it and all. So we don't say Epauchi. We say the super rich, the less than one half of 1% who really own most of the wealth. Now, whenever you ascribe conscious intent and pursuit of self-interest at the top, you'll hear someone say, well, what are you, a conspiracy theorist? You can say farmers consciously organize to pursue their interests, and everybody will say, uh-huh, the farmers are organized. You can say machinists or auto workers are organizing, and everybody says, uh-huh. They're consciously organizing and pursuing, or school teachers or other people. But if you say that the people who own most of America and most of the world, if you say they consciously organize and pursue things to get what they want, then you hear people saying, oh, you have a conspiracy theory? You think they really do that? The alternative to a conspiracy theory is an innocence theory. That is, they do all this stuff, but they're not pursuing self-interest. They just do it, you know. The other alternative is a somnambulist theory. Somnambulism is the tendency to walk in your sleep. David Rockefeller gets up in the morning and he says, what am I going to do to advance my interests and protect my interests? No, that would be conspiratorial. Hey, well, that stuff happens, whatever. That's okay. Another alternative would be coincidence theory. It's just a coincidence that this happened. Or sometimes a variation of coincidence theory is uncanny theory. Then there's stupidity theory and incompetence theory. Don't laugh at that one. That's used all the time. I have had about a 20-year argument with my co-politicists on the left to stop calling Ronald Reagan stupid, to stop calling George Bush stupid. It's good for a joke or something, but that guy knew what he was doing, and he did it. He got rid of the inheritance tax for the super rich. He cut corporate taxes down to almost nothing. He doubled the military budget. He waged two major wars and got this country into war and left it that way. He deregulated, well, actually another creep before him named Bill Clinton deregulated the banking system and all that to create this disaster that we've been facing. These guys know what they're doing, and they know who they're doing it for. They're doing it for themselves. But they will actually even use this idea of incompetence theory to save their asses. When Reagan was on the line and brought before that court because of Iran-Contra, after Poindexter fell on the sword for him and said, oh, no, the president didn't know. Yeah, like they were going to do this whole scheme, these billions of dollars down to the Contras, conniving with Iran and all this. They're going to do this without telling the president, without clearing it with him. Cabinet-level people are going to just do this. Of course. And then Weinberger and all these others. It turns out Reagan knew all about it. Reagan was the guy who okayed it. And Reagan's defense was incompetence theory, saying, you know, I just really got to get a better grasp on what's going on here. I should be more hands-on. And everybody going, oh, Ronnie, what a dumb dodo. He didn't know. All right, he doesn't go to jail. All right. So then there's also stochastic theory. Stochasticism among intellectual academic circles, which is filled with people who have too much time on their hands. They make up words like stochasticism. It means everything happening by random. There's really no causality as such. So, you know, stuff just happens. So history is just these eventualities that just tumble down on top of each other like that. And stochasticism theory has a use. I mean, there are times when such things happen that you could have a very rational causality of people settling in a valley, let's say, because the land is fertile, the water is good and all that. And so you got one set of causalities, and then you have the mountain on the side, and that has a geological strata, and that has another set, and then one day the mountain comes down and crashes down and kills the people. The mountain didn't intend to kill the people. And that would be a stochastic happening where two eventualities quite accidentally collide and hit each other. So there is in history both causality and accident. We're not saying there aren't accidents at times, but is everything an accident when it comes from the top down? Well, the deep ideology that serves the interests of the owning corporate class sometimes peeks through in the mass line ideology when there are denunciations of socialism and when equating government regulations with totalitarianism. Oh, I already told you that. Let me go on. It's reached the point now on conspiracy where it has become one of those requisite genuflection renunciations hardened by convention. That is where you have to deny it. You have to disassociate yourself. You have to be saying something. Let me give you an analogy. It's very much like in the 1980s when you had the requisite genuflection was to make an anti-Soviet comment. I can think of leading progressive writers who could not criticize U.S. foreign policy without saying, and if we do that, we'll be as bad as the Soviets in Afghanistan. Every third paragraph or so, there had to be a sideswipe, and you had to flash a sign. And I would say to one or two of them, why don't you just wear a big sign saying, I am an anti-communist? That's fine. And then once you hold it up, we'll all agree. And you don't have to keep making these genuflections. I can remember a colleague of mine when I was back at a postdoctoral at Yale, doing this, or at Yale, the guy who's already, I said, Bill, you know, you got tenure. You got to keep flashing your anti-communist, anti-Soviet card. He was talking about policy in Africa and this and that, and there were all sorts of other things we could say. So that kind of hardened genuflection, it's a concept that is demonized, and it's needed. Let me give you an example. Walter Karp, and it hurts me to take Walter because he was a wonderful guy. He's dead now. He wrote a book called Indispensable Enemies, 1974. He writes as follows. When it can be established, and he's writing about conspiracy, when it can be established that a number of political acts work in concert to produce a certain result, the presumption is strong that the actors were aiming at the result in question. Yes. When it can be shown, in addition, that the actors have an interest in producing these results, the presumptions become a fair certainty. And then he says, no conspiracy theory is required. You see, he has to disassociate. He's making a very intelligent conspiracy analysis, but he's got to disassociate and he's got to genuflect himself by saying, I'm not making a conspiracy theory here. No conspiracy theory is required. That's right. No conspiracy theory. A conspiracy analysis is being made, and you just made it. I'll tell you more, he says, because it's really good. He says, on the other hand, those who make blanket condemnations of conspiracy theories base their own view on a far-fetched theory indeed, namely that whatever those in high office actually do, they are essentially men of goodwill. So you have those people who say there can't be such conspiracies because our leaders are people of goodwill. They have good intentions, and that's the way they are. I'll return to that point later. According to this school of special pleading, the king can do no wrong doctrine, suitably updated, it is entirely proper to praise an American president for skillfully engineering some desirable result. But to ascribe to him the same skillful engineering of an indefensible one is to fall victim to political paranoia and conspiratorial fetishism. I mean, that's not – Karp doesn't believe that. He's saying that's the way these people think, that when the president does something craftily and cleverly and succeeds and wins a victory, everybody says, oh, that was good political leadership. That's what that was. But if you say he would use craft and guile and skill to perpetrate unsavory ends like starting a war of aggression, then that's conspiracy theory that you're having. And there are these other two words. He mentioned one of the other two words. You see it in the press regularly. If they don't say you're suffering from conspiracy theory, they'll say you're being paranoiac or you're being cynical. The cynical view, that's the other term that's sometimes used. So what we're facing, and not only from mainstream media and conventional academics, but even from among some leading progressive writers, we're facing a knee-jerk resistance to ascribing intent or covert actions and such by dismissing such ascriptions as conspiracy theory. So the term conspiracy theory is used to dismiss, one, the idea of a conscious design by policymakers. Two, a hidden but knowing intent. Three, a secret plan. Four, a secret interest. The term conspiracy theory is applied in two dimensions. The first dimension focuses on specific actions and events: an assassination, an act of terrorism, a mysterious disappearance of giant skyscrapers, a dirty deal in business, which is an illegal one. Or the second ascription is to dismiss an entire class interest, an entire social and ideological agenda. Rulers do not rule from secret intent. Do you get the difference? I mean, one is about specific actions and the other is about the whole system and structure. This explains why somebody, say, like Noam Chomsky, who does very good and very valuable work, this is not to take away anything from him in other areas, but I've had differences with him over the JFK assassination. Noam Chomsky, Alexander Coburn, Chip Berlet, they denounce this conspiracy theory and they say if you're a radical, you don't go looking at these little hokey-pokey secret plots, most of them imagined, even a few might be real, so what? Because there's the larger, bigger picture you got to look at. He's surprised, and they are surprised to find out, that they themselves are thought of as conspiracy theorists. There are people who think Noam Chomsky is a conspiracy theorist because of that second use of the term, that is, using it to mean a whole class power systemic intent that's directed toward certain kinds of forces. Behind the left rejection of the concept of conspiracy theory in academic circles is this structuralist functionalist debate that's gone on. Many of you have not heard about this structuralist functionalist debate over the years. You have every reason to be grateful that you haven't. It shows that you haven't been wasting your goddamn time on this issue. Well, the debate goes something like this. If you try to explain things through incidental or idiosyncratic analysis, this is very poor analysis, you know. If you try to say, well, the Spanish-American War happened because McKinley was all sort of scared and weak and Teddy Roosevelt was a real bombastic, and these personalities of the actors, and that brought the war on, or King Louis, who was it? King Louis says, no, it wouldn't be King Louis says, gave aid to the American revolutionaries because, I forget, somebody killed his pet cat and he got angry at the guy and so forth, and somebody, you know, little incidentalist stories like this, or for personalities and such, that is a very limited and dubious analysis of trying to explain historical phenomena, that the more impersonal and the more systemic, then the more radical. And the more systemic, the less volitional. The broader is the scope when you have a systemic analysis, and the deeper is the depth of your analysis, it is assumed. But what they're assuming here, you see, is a conflict between structural factors and functional factors, volitional factors, where people are consciously acting as actors with conscious intent. Because, in fact, the structure plays itself out through volitional forces. You have to have volitional forces. The CIA is itself neither. Is the CIA structuralist or is it functionalist? Functionalist, in other words, functionalist is discarded. Conspiracy theory is discarded as a form of functionalism. And Michael Abbott and Noam Chomsky had an article on that in Z Magazine. They call themselves structuralists, that they have structural. And I had a contract on a book I was writing at the time, Against Empire, with, what was that, the publishing house in Maine, the Common Courage. He didn't want to go on with the project. I canceled it with him, and I switched it over to City Lights as my publisher. And he said on the phone, this was after I had written that thing on JFK assassination. He said, well, you're a functionalist, and I'm a structuralist. You know, and I had other words for what he was and what I was, sounding something like structuralist and functionalist. And I'm saying, what is wrong with these guys? They suffer from in academia, academics are never happier than when they can choose up sides. And they can dichotomize an issue. Well, you're a structuralist, I'm a functionalist, or you're a something otherist, and I'm a this-ist, and then they choose up, and they start fighting, and they have little, you're a behavioralist, and I'm a intentionalist, or you're a this and this, and I'm a that-a-list. That's when they're really happy. And, of course, most of the time, these things aren't mutually exclusive. These functions play out. The CIA, as I started to say, the CIA is a structured conspiracy operation. You know, you could say, is the CIA a systemic agency that's part of a whole overriding class interest that must mobilize power in a certain way and does these things and operates that way? Or is it a bunch of conspirators who are doing that? And there are those of us who say, why can't it be both? Doesn't A and B, don't A and B serve each other perfectly well? But as I say, if you're so busy choosing up sides to keep yourself busy, they have too much time on their hands. History plays out functionally within the confines of structural developments. Did you get that down? That's a direct quote from Michael Parenti. Okay. I should have read it more slowly. I see some of you are fumbling for pens. Oh, you want me to read it again? All right. History plays out functionally within the confines of structural developments. I don't even know what that means, but that sounds like this.
You've just been listening to a speech by Michael Parenti at the Understanding Deep Politics Conference in Santa Cruz, California on May 15th, 2010. Tune in next week to hear the final part of that speech. You can also catch the video of the speech at the website understandingdeeppolitics.org. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, building bridges.
Dear Mr. President, come take a walk with me.
Take a walk with me.
Let's pretend we're just two people and you're not better than me. I'd like to ask you some questions if we can speak honestly. What do you feel when you see all the homeless on the streets? Who do you pray for a night before you go to sleep? What do you feel when you look in the mirror? Are you proud? How do you sleep while the rest of us cry? How do you dream when a mother has no chance to say goodbye? How do you walk with your head held high? Can you even look me?
I'm Ken Nash with Mary Rosenberg with a Building Bridges, Not Walls DNC election special with news and analysis from within the halls of power.
Going behind the pomp and circumstances of the DNC to bring you the real deal. Fighting for people's power.
Later on Building Bridges, Deborah Berger, co-president of National Nurses United. But first...
Well, somebody who's always out there fighting the power. The People's Organization for Progress is an independent, grassroots, community-based, politically progressive association working for racial, social, and economic justice and the fundamental transformation of this country towards a more just society. And fighting the power, that's what the People's Organization for Progress does with its chairperson, Larry Hamm. Joining us from the DNC is Bernie Feeling the Burn, Sanders delegate to the DNC, Larry Hamm.
How are you?
How do you analyze and what is your position? We now know that and expected as much that Hillary was going to be the nominee. Some number of Bernie delegates walked out and held a protest in the press tent. What is your perspective on... And as a Bernie delegate, where do you go from here?
I am a delegate to the Democratic National Convention for Bernie Sanders. I was glad to be a delegate and glad to have had that experience. I have to say, I'm extremely disappointed that Bernie Sanders did not get the nomination. I wished it could have been otherwise, but we all know what the outcome is. Some of us suspected, even myself from the beginning, having had the experience of being in the Jesse Jackson campaigns of 84 and 88, that probably Bernie would have a similar experience. But he ran a tremendous campaign, and I guess he was the right man at the right time because the outpouring of support was really phenomenal. From a guy who had a 3% name recognition among the public initially to coming to the convention with 45% of the pledged delegates. But personally, as painful as it is, I'm a Sanders delegate, and I am speaking for myself now. I am going to follow the guidance of Bernie Sanders with regard to where do we go from here, and that is that we have to defeat Donald Trump. With all the problems we had with Hillary Clinton, and Bernie Sanders made those contradictions clear during the primary season, what the problems were. With all the problems, the prospect of a Trump presidency and that Donald Trump could appoint as many as 4 Supreme Court justices, which would shape the jurisprudence in this country for the next 25 years, maybe even half a century, is totally unacceptable. My position is that there's only 100 days left. The only 2 major contenders, there's only one of them will be the president, and I think we have to do all that we can to make sure that's not Donald Trump. And say this publicly so there's no secrecy, I personally am going to vote for Hillary Clinton because I know that that is what has to be done to defeat Donald Trump. But at the same time, I understand the pain that other Bernie Sanders supporters and delegates feel, and I actually respect their opinion and respect their right to cast their vote in whatever way they feel they should do. That's their right. Some of them are being moved by conscience, and I understand that. But for me personally, I'm going to vote for Hillary Clinton. I'm going to do everything in my power to make sure that Donald Trump does not become the president, because he represents, his movement has in it our worst enemies, you know, the Klan, the neo-Nazis, the white supremacists, the white nationalists, they're all there. And he's made clear that his policies are going to reflect the tendencies that in his movement.
Let me also ask you, in the remaining time that there is with the Democratic National Convention, and of course thereafter, to what extent do some of the policy issues that Bernie represented wind up getting pushed further to enhance or change or inform the positions of Hillary Clinton and her running mate, Tim Kaine, around trade, around police violence, about universal health care, Medicare for all, things of those sort? Do you think that there's that kind of possibility? And is any of that going to be a point of pressure on the Democratic convention floor for the rest of the time?
In the words of Bernie Sanders, this Democratic National Convention platform is the most progressive probably in the history of the party. That being said, people have to understand that a few of the planks, such as the $15 an hour minimum wage, did eventually get in as is. But other Bernie Sanders platform planks came in the modified version and pushed Hillary Clinton to the left, so to speak. Whereas she had one position, let's say, on free public college tuition. Now that's in the platform in the sense that, as Bernie explained it in the caucus the other day, that families with incomes up to $125,000, children in those families would be able to have free public college education, and that I think must be at least 83 to 85% of families when you raise the income bar that high. Expansion of a Medicare. Bernie Sanders was pushing for universal single payer health care. That didn't make it in as is, but expanded Medicare coverage. In fact, giving people the option of coming in at 55 instead of 65. And also being the option, having a public option, which, as you know, was discarded by the Obama administration during the first term, that made it in. Now, you know, Bernie Sanders is opposed to the TPP. And even Hillary Clinton has said she's opposed to the TPP. However, explicit opposition to the TPP did not make it into the platform, but language opposing unfair trade deals that hurt American working people, language like that is in the platform. And also even modification of some of the rules that govern the Democratic Party. Like with this convention, we have 600 superdelegates. But now, as a result of negotiations between the Sanders campaign and their participation on the platform committee, now the number of superdelegates is going to be reduced to 250. That's a significant step forward. My position, my personal position, is that should be in superdelegates, period. But, you know, you can see that the ball has been moved down the field, so to speak. And I think people should be proud, and there are many others. We don't have time to go through them all here. There are many others. I think people should be proud of that. But I went through this in 1988, and I know, you know, you pass a great platform at the convention, and then, you know, if you don't have a movement to hold whoever is in the White House accountable, then it's just another document. And the implementation of that platform has to be one of our goals once we get past November the 8th. Look, we have a choice between proto-fascism in the form of Donald Trump's campaign and movement and neoliberalism with Hillary Clinton. Both are undesirable, but we can defeat the fascist and emerging fascist movement in this country, and we should defeat them decisively and then continue the struggle against neoliberalism after the November election. The movement doesn't end. It's not an event. It's not an episode. It's an ongoing process. And the Sanders camp is going to be severely tested over the next 12 months. Bernie Sanders has never wavered in saying that You know, we're trying to build a movement for political revolution in this country. He said that he's going to turn his campaign organization into an organization to continue to fight for racial, social, economic, and environmental justice and peace beyond November. He said he's going to support progressive candidates from the lowest level, school board, to the highest level, Congress, over the next few years. Whether or not all of that happens will depend in great deal on the different tendencies. See, people have to understand, even in the Bernie Sanders movement, there are different political tendencies. Yet, the Bernie Sanders movement is a movement opposing the establishment and conservative Democrats and the corporate Democrats. Yes, but within the Bernie Sanders movement itself, there are different tendencies. And if these tendencies aren't able to reconcile their differences, yes, we will have activity, we will have protests, we will have other conventions, et cetera, et cetera. But we will not be able to reach that critical mass to carry out the ultimate mission, which, as Bernie Sanders said just yesterday, the social transformation of this country, the fundamental social transformation of this country. And this is what the Jackson, the Rainbow Coalition, went through after 1988. The different tendencies were struggling, and eventually, because of resistance, you know, on the part of some of the leadership and some of the forces within the Rainbow Coalition, that movement ultimately came to a halt. And so the Sanders movement, I should say, is going to be tested in the same way from here to the November election and beyond. We got to try to hold. We made a significant advance. This is my personal opinion.
And we have about 30 seconds left.
Right. We made a significant advance for progressive politics, left politics in this country. The Sanders campaign opened, widened the space for progressive politics. That genie of progressive politics is out of the bottle, and we must do everything in our power to prevent those who want to put the genie back into the bottle. We have to make sure that this movement continues.
And with people like Larry Hamm and the People's Organization for Progress, we will make it so. Thanks from that report. I can hear a little bit of the tiredness in your voice.
Yes.
And I want to promise that our listeners, we're going to do some serious, serious work and discussion around where progressives move in the election period as the months progress. And certainly people like Larry Hamm are going to be a fundamental part of those discussions. Larry Hamm, always a pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you, Nene.
We'll see you when you
get back.
I have a dream.
Healthcare.
One day.
Justice. Healthcare. Justice.
America of the people. America by the people. America for the people. Which people are you talking about? Are you talking about the wealthy with the means to stay healthy while 47 million go without? No doubt. We need a revolution. It's time for a brand new healthcare solution. Sing it on behalf of the uninsured, because I believe it's so absurd for America, the so-called greatest nation, to be in a healthcare crisis situation.
Someday, this nation will rise up.
Well, we are now joined by another person who has been on the floor of the Democratic National Convention, the 185,000-strong National Nurses United are still feeling the burn, having endorsed Bernie Sanders for president. The scrubs-wearing symbols continue to seek to inject a healthier, more progressive energy into the presidential nominating convention of the Democrats in Philadelphia, which began by their co-hosting a forum at the DNC to continue the campaign for guaranteed health care through an improved and expanded Medicare for All. Reporting from the DNC is Deborah Berger, president of the National Nurses United and a working nurse.
Oh, my pleasure.
Deborah, your feelings as one of the big, important unions and one of the few that supported Bernie Sanders, and what we experienced from news reports were people who were severely distressed, demoralized, and walked out of the convention in protest. Your thoughts now about where National Nurses United goes?
We are a collective, and we make group decisions. That's how we run our organization. We talk to our nurses, we get their feedback and input, and then based on that information, we make a decision, and we're not ready to move on yet. As nurses, we know it takes time in the grieving process to fully assimilate all of the emotions and do the right thing in a rational manner. And we just want to make sure that we aren't overreacting or anything like that. So it's going to take some time because the Bernie supporters have had a loss. You know, it's like a death in the family. There's the grieving process. We have to go through that. And in the end, we'll come out stronger for that process, and we're just eternally grateful that Senator Sanders embodied all of the values that nurses hold dear and will continue to fight the political revolution going beyond this convention and going beyond this election. It doesn't stop because either Trump or Hillary get elected president. We are going to continue.
And I'm wondering how you feel about the Democratic Party's relationship to organized labor. You know, one of the things that hit me with the many, many, many speakers, and the convention isn't over, it seems that there's a fully exploitative relationship. Use their phone banks, use their membership power for door-to-door canvassing. But my goodness, organized labor, the working person still gets short shrift. Your thoughts?
Well, I actually agree. They did have a token labor moment. They had the leadership from four or five of the larger unions and President Rich Trumka on the same stage. He really, in my opinion, should have as a position of trust and as an elected official representing all unions, should have had his own time on the stage, just as other prominent politicians had time on the stage. They lumped him together with several other unions. They had like a few minutes, and then, you know, that was done. They weren't on prime time, so they were just sort of like, here's the checklist that we're going to use. Okay, so we've got labor check. We've got Americans with disabilities check. We've got the women's group check. We've got people of color check. And so it was really kind of, I thought, insulting that President Trumka didn't have a major role in the program because he does represent labor. And you're right, they do use our energy and our willingness to canvass and door knock and phone call, but weren't really highlighted in any major way. So that is unfortunate.
And of course, we've been talking about Richard Trumka, who is the head of the AFL-CIO. And though the nurses did two extraordinary forums there, participated in, et cetera, and they were pivotal in, one on the very issue that I raised in the introduction, which is an improved and expanded Medicare mm-hmm. for all and to defeat the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And I wonder if you can talk mm-hmm. about the role that the nurses played. And they've just been extraordinary as a union in terms of their courage and their outgoingness around these issues and so many more. It's been refreshing, to say the least.
The thing is that people say, why do nurses care about the Trans-Pacific Partnership deal, right? It's like, why do they care? You know, their jobs aren't being shipped overseas. But we care because there are many, many provisions in the Trans-Pacific Partnership treaty that will delay generic drugs from coming onto the market, that will keep foods being labeled GMO, will keep things from being labeled organic. There's all of these provisions that say if a company loses potential profits, not real profits, but potential profits, they can sue through the tribunal, and we as taxpayers will end up paying fines to these companies for their potential loss of profits. There's many, many terrible provisions in the Trans-Pacific Partnership Treaty that are so bad, and it's really not highlighted. The media and the politicians don't want people to know how bad it is. I think they should go to publiccitizen.org and look, because they've done an exhaustive study of that information and help get the word out. And as for Medicare for All, nurses have for decades supported an improved and expanded Medicare for All, because we see the consequences of patients not having access to health care, and it can be a real death sentence if they don't get that care. And that's for the first time the Democratic platform does not have single payer on their platform, and that's a national disgrace.
Wait a minute. You're saying for the first time it doesn't?
It doesn't.
Really? I mean, I didn't know that it did.
It has in decades past had the goal of the Democratic Party to be a proponent for Medicare for All, single payer, universal health care. And the platform that they put together in Orlando did not include that.
Oh, that's really significant. Wow. Backtracking one step
forward. It's disappointing because they're saying essentially that the Affordable Care Act is good enough.
Wow. So let me also ask you, in the time we have left, where do you see, National Nurses United go in carrying forward these issues? And I have to say, again, I find dealing with National Nurses United so vibrant, so refreshing. They've immersed themselves in so many issues of community beyond just the bread and butter collective bargaining agreements of their respective unions, which are very important. But they've taken the issue of organized labor and melded it with the community needs. And I really find that you are the most exciting and important union in the country at this point, National Nurses United. So how do you take these issues forward after the campaign, Deborah Berger?
Well, we made very, very good, strong ties with the community as a result of our campaign work with Senator Sanders. And those ties and relationships are going to continue afterwards, because it doesn't do us good to have good salary, good benefits, and a cushy job if our community members don't have benefits and an adequate living and a good education. So we are continuing those issues, and we are making them a priority. We did sponsor the Medicare for All Forum because we felt it was important to get the information out there. The Affordable Care Act isn't the solution. It only keeps the insurance companies in play and price gouging. They're increasing premiums by 14% or more in California. So we want to make sure that we can continue this fight. And we had the People's Summit just before this convention, and we've made plans to actually elect more progressive candidates in the down-ticket races across the country, and we plan on holding those politicians accountable. And if they don't do what we elected them to, we are going to run challenge candidates.
Very exciting. Very exciting. Deborah Berg, I really want to thank you for joining us. This has been a brief discussion where we've looked at some of the issues that National Nurses United have raised within the context of Democratic National Convention. Do you want to take us out with a message of where you all go from here and where we all need to go in terms of making sure that there really is people's power? Because that's what this is all about in the final analysis.
Well, I think one of the things that is a takeaway lesson that we've learned from this election cycle and working with the Bernie campaign is that it's not enough to work in your little silo and your one little issue. You have to be able to work on a global, more holistic approach to all of the issues because they are interconnected. And a harm to one is really a harm to others. And as Tulsi Gabbard said yesterday, your child is my child. Your problems are my problems. And we have to work together to make a more democratic process and to make this society in the United States a more compassionate and caring society.
And of course, I'm speaking to a working nurse. What else would I expect but other than a healing message? And the 185,000 strong National Nurses United and its leadership has been nothing other than injecting healthier, more progressive energy into the presidential nominating convention and, frankly, into the work that they do, melding labor with community-based issues. Thank you so much, Deborah Berger, president of National Nurses United, for your report from the DNC.
Thank you very much for your time.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
This Way Out.
horribly, practically violent speeches were being spewed there, full of racial hatred, anti-gay.
You know what Trump said about the really hideous anti-LGBT platform? It's very good.
I am proud to be gay. I am proud to be a Republican.
As your president, I will do everything in my power to protect our LGBTQ citizens from the violence of a hateful foreign ideology.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. Romanians could consider banning marriage equality, India's government advances transgender protections, and U.S. Republicans party till they trump. Those stories and more this week because you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Wenzel Jones.
And I'm John Dyer V.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBT communities around the world for the week ending July 23rd, 2016. Romania's Constitutional Court this week approved a right-wing anti-LGBT group's effort to constitutionally define marriage as exclusively heterosexual. The ruling allows Romania's parliament to vote on the proposal. The current definition of civil marriage in Romania refers to spouses without specifying gender. Any constitutional change would require a three-quarters vote in parliament, which would then put the issue before voters in a referendum. The nine judges on the country's highest court wrote that they were not addressing the issue of marriage equality itself, only ruling unanimously that a petition circulated by the Coalition for the Family and signed by 3 million Romanians this year to change the Constitution's definition of marriage was valid. LGBT rights activists staged protests of the court ruling in downtown Bucharest. They held banners reading "Love Above Dogma" and "Love Is Not a Sin," printed on a background of rainbow hearts, and chanted "Equal Rights." The Associated Press reported that police took the personal details of people taking part in the rally, and even journalists who were covering it, because the gathering wasn't authorized by City Hall.
Homosexual acts were decriminalized in Romania in 2001. While the Eastern European nation doesn't specifically outlaw civil marriage for same-gender couples, it doesn't legally recognize them. Only a handful of politicians support marriage equality in the socially conservative nation of 20 million, where the powerful Romanian Orthodox Church often dominates political debate. Parliament is currently in its summer recess.
The far-right U.S. group, Liberty Council, best known for defending homophobic marriage license-refusing Kentucky County Clerk Kim Davis, bragged via a Christian Newswire press release this week that the brief they submitted in favor of natural marriage played an instrumental role in the Romanian High Court's decision.
But India's government has advanced new protections for its transgender citizens. The Transgender Person Protection of Rights Bill 2016 was approved by the cabinet this week with the support of Prime Minister Narendra Modi for introduction in Parliament. Through this bill, a press statement said, the government has evolved a mechanism for social, economic, and educational empowerment. The bill will benefit a large number of transgender persons, mitigate the stigma, discrimination, and abuse against this marginalized section, and bring them into the mainstream of society. The proposal includes punishments of up to 2 years in prison for committing violence or publicly humiliating trans people. It specifically defines violence as any physical or verbal attack, as well as forcing trans people to leave their village, forcibly removing their clothes, parading them naked, or inciting them to beg. The bill also authorizes a new National Council of Transgender People.
In other news, a record crowd of 25,000 LGBT activists and their allies hit the streets of Jerusalem on July 21st for the city's annual Pride Parade. According to Israeli media, just 5,000 people participated last year. This year's 15th annual parade was dedicated to the memory of Shira Banki, a 16-year-old girl who was stabbed to death by an ultra-Orthodox Jewish extremist at last year's parade. He also wounded 6 others. Many marchers laid flowers under a large picture of Banki at the site of her murder. Some 2,000 uniformed police and plainclothes officers were on hand to keep the festivities peaceful. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu referenced last year's violence at Jerusalem Pride and last month's massacre at Orlando's Pulse nightclub in a strongly worded video message urging all Israelis to support this year's march.
Loving someone should never mean a life of fear or terror. Surrounding us are regimes who literally murder you for being gay. In Israel, the LGBT community marches with pride. My unwavering belief is that all people are created equal. Dignity, respect, acceptance. These are the values that will triumph.
But Jerusalem mayor Nir Barkat drew ire from equality advocates for refusing to march in the procession because his announcement claimed it offends the national religious public. It might be worth noting that the recently elected Muslim mayor of London, Sadiq Khan, led his city's pride parade last month.
But a first-ever pride march was canceled earlier this month in southern Israel's largest city, Beersheba, after police and city officials predicted a strong likelihood of life-threatening violence against participants. Israel's Supreme Court suggested that organizers choose a less-traveled alternate route, but they canceled the event instead, noting that the point of pride is to be seen.
There are two related U.S. sports stories this week. The National Basketball Association, or NBA, has officially pulled its February 2017 All-Star Game out of Charlotte, North Carolina, because of the state's discriminatory law known as HB2. That law forbids local city and county officials from passing laws that protect their LGBT citizens from discrimination and demands that trans people use public bathrooms that correspond to the gender on their birth certificate. Citing the refusal of North Carolina lawmakers to substantially fix the law, the official NBA statement issued on July 21st said, in part, that we are particularly mindful of the impact of this decision on our fans in North Carolina. Charlotte Hornet fans are among the most passionate in our league. It is also important to stress, the statement added, that the city of Charlotte and the Hornets organization have sought to provide an inclusive environment and that the Hornets will continue to ensure that all patrons, including members of the LGBT community, feel welcome while attending games and events in their arena. The All-Star Game could be held in Charlotte in 2019, provided that there's an appropriate resolution to this matter, the statement said. New Orleans is reportedly in the running to replace Charlotte in 2017. The Speaker of the Massachusetts House made a symbolic bid for next year's All-Star Game, citing his state's recently enacted laws protecting transgender people.
The National Collegiate Athletic Association, or NCAA, followed suit the following day. All cities bidding to host college championship games or tournaments must now certify that they have policies banning discrimination or, conversely, admit that they have regulations that interfere with any person's choice of bathroom or locker room. All cities bidding for future games or tournaments must fill out a survey attesting to their non-discrimination policies by August 12th. Cities that have already been granted championship rounds will also need to submit the survey by an as-yet unspecified date. That could be a challenge for officials in Greensboro, North Carolina. The city is scheduled to host the second and third rounds of the 2017 Men's Division I basketball tournament, the wildly popular series of elimination games known as March Madness. The city of Indianapolis, Indiana, the state with GOP vice presidential nominee and current Governor Mike Pence's discriminatory so-called religious freedom law, is also scheduled to host two rounds of March Madness next year. The July 22nd announcement follows up on a vote in April by the NCAA governing board to require bidding cities to demonstrate how they will provide an environment that is safe, healthy, and free of discrimination. An NCAA spokesperson confirmed that the new requirements apply to all championship rounds, not just the title games.
And finally, a July 22nd story in Mississippi's Clarion Ledger newspaper confirms that the U.S. state's Protecting Freedom of Conscience from Government Discrimination Act, known as HB 1523, was written not by lawmakers, but by the people behind the Christian legal advocacy group Alliance Defending Freedom. The law allows businesses, individuals, and public servants to deny service to LGBT people or anyone else they don't like based on religious belief or moral conviction. According to email messages obtained through court order by attorney Roberta Kaplan, who's challenging her home state's discriminatory law in a federal lawsuit, the right-wing group drafted much of the language in the bill and even helped write Republican Governor Phil Bryant's signing speech. Alliance Defending Freedom was co-founded by Donald Wildman Sr., who also created the rabidly homophobic American Family Association. Governor Bryant issued a statement saying that it is perfectly normal for our office to work with individuals and organizations who have had a role in requesting and or opposing legislation during the bill review process to gather additional information. But the Clarion Ledger notes that Alliance Defending Freedom is an avowedly Christian organization and that the bill only protects certain religious views that coincide with Christianity. Kaplan, the attorney whose lawsuit successfully overturned the Federal Defense of Marriage Act, or DOMA, in 2013, suggests that the email revelations prove that HB 1523 violates the clause in the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution that prohibits government establishment of religion. U.S. District Judge Carlton Reeves has already ruled that HB 1523 is unconstitutional, but the state is appealing.
That's News Wrap for the week ending July 23, 2016. Produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org. You can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Wenzel Jones.
And I'm John Dyer V.
Don't forget that most men with nothing would rather protect the possibility of becoming rich than face the reality of being poor. And that is why they will follow us.
To the right, ever to the right.
In U.S. politics, the quadrennial Republican National Convention is usually expected to be a smooth, rather staid event. But 2016 has not been a usual presidential election year. The GOP convocation from July 18th through 21st in Cleveland, Ohio, was clearly going to be a bumpy ride when their prospective nominee for First Lady gave an opening night speech that was not entirely original. Gay USA's Andy Hum and Ann Northrup reported on the Melania Trump controversy and other inconvenient convention truths.
Melania's famous plagiarism was exposed, if you didn't know, by an African-American gay journalist.
It was all blown open by Jarrett Hill, who used to work with Soledad O'Brien, youngish gay black man, who was watching the speech and said, "Wait a minute, I've heard that before." And he looked up Michelle Obama's convention speeches and said, "This is the same thing." And he took the texts, put them together, put them on Twitter, and boom, the world blew up. I don't think it was the biggest crime ever committed, but I do think the crime was how horribly they reacted to this and lied about it. And then they get up and talk about Hillary lying with a straight face. And then you have little moments like Trump walking out on Monday night to We Are the Champions, which the band Queen has objected to. He's used this repeatedly. They object every time he uses it, and he just keeps using it.
I don't care.
Exactly.
I don't care. That's what he says. I don't care. But, of course, it distracted from what was a hate fest on the first night.
Exactly.
I mean, these horribly, practically violent speeches that were being spewed there, full of racial hatred, anti-gay. I mean, the only time sexual orientation was mentioned was by Rudy Giuliani in a really horrible speech. But all he was saying was, you know, the cops don't ask what your sexual orientation is when they come to save you, you know, or race or anything like that. But that's it. That's not exactly affirming our rights.
It was nice that the Cleveland City Council, just before the Republicans arrived, passed a non-discrimination bill for gender identity, including public accommodations like bathrooms. That was a little slap in the face to the Republicans. We appreciated that. Meanwhile, the Republican Party has nominated virulently anti-LGBT Mike Pence for Vice President of the United States. You know, we knew this was coming, and it just gave me the worst feeling in the pit of my stomach as they moved towards nominating Mike Pence. Not that Chris Christie or Newt Gingrich would have been an improvement.
Well, Mike Pence is the governor of Indiana and was in a lot of trouble in terms of being reelected in the state of Indiana because they're sick of him. Even in Indiana, which often votes Republican in presidential elections, mostly votes Republican in presidential elections. But Mike Pence, what a record as a congressman, as a radio talk show host, and as governor. This is a guy who got up on the floor of Congress and said, smoking doesn't kill people. I mean, just to give you an example.
Mike Pence has a 100% rating from the NRA when he was in Congress, a zero rating from the Human Rights Campaign, backed by the Family Research Council very heavily. You know, proudly introduces himself as
a Christian, a conservative, and a Republican in that order.
Totally anti-abortion, you know.
A defunded Planned Parenthood. And Mike Pence was proposing legislation that would punish doctors and ban some forms of contraception.
In 2000, he wouldn't allow federal funding to care for people with HIV/AIDS unless money was cut to programs that, quote, celebrate and encourage the types of behaviors that facilitate the spreading of the HIV virus.
He wanted funds instead dedicated to helping people change the behavior that spreads HIV, according to him.
He voted against the Employment Non-Discrimination Act. He voted against repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. He voted for a constitutional amendment to ban same-sex marriage. This is a bill that had no chance of passing, but that he voted for.
Voted against inclusion of us in hate crimes bills, voted against anything helping trans students.
But they're acting like, oh, nobody knows who Mike Pence is. Well, no, he was quite famous just last year because he signed this really outrageous Religious Freedom Restoration Act. We have a picture of him at the bill signing. You know, he surrounds himself with nuns in habits. Very few nuns wear habits anymore, so they had to be far right. And some Orthodox Jews are visible there with the hats and all this kind of stuff. But we have another picture which tells you who are the people standing with him. Well, the guy with the beard there is Micah Clark, who believes homosexuality is a treatable disorder. Behind him in the back is Kurt Smith, who equates homosexuality with bestiality, and he helped write the bill. And behind Pence is Eric Miller, who propagandized that pastors could be jailed for preaching against homosexuality. Lies, lies, lies.
I mean, this guy is really right-wing. And then he, you may also remember, I rewatched this. You can find it on YouTube. The humiliating interview he did with George Stephanopoulos.
Is Advance America right when they say a florist in Indiana can now refuse to serve a gay couple without fear of punishment?
Well, let me explain.
If a florist in Indiana refuses to serve a gay couple at their wedding, is that legal now in Indiana?
George.
It said it would protect a Christian florist who against any kind of punishment. Is that true or not?
George.
Does that mean that Christians who want to refuse service, or people of any other faith who want to refuse service to gays and lesbians, that it's now legal in the state of Indiana? That's a simple yes or no question.
George.
Do you think it should be legal in the state of Indiana to discriminate against gays or lesbians?
George.
Yes or no, should it be legal to discriminate against gays and lesbians?
George.
Hillary could nominate Pokemon as her vice president, and he would beat Pence in a debate.
Mainstream press accounts generally overlooked Pence's anti-LGBT background and easily took the bait the GOP laid out to give the impression that the party's attitude had evolved. Silicon Valley billionaire Peter Thiel was hailed as the first gay man to identify himself as such on a Republican convention stage.
When I was a kid, the great debate was about how to defeat the Soviet Union, and we won. Now we are told that the great debate is about who gets to use which bathroom. This is a distraction from our real problems. Who cares? Of course, every American has a unique identity. I am proud to be gay. I am proud to be a Republican. But most of all,
I am proud to be an American. I don't pretend to agree with every plank in our party's platform, but fake culture wars only distract us from our economic decline. And nobody in this race is being honest about it except Donald Trump.
Peter Thiel's Republican convention speech was put in perspective by journalist Sam Biddle on Democracy Now!
His background ideologically is all over the place. He has stated that democracy and freedom are incompatible. He's said that women should have never had the right to vote in the United States. He believes in the construction of man-made islands where the U.S. government has no sovereignty. And now he's a Trump delegate, which I think is really a natural progression in a series of fringe, silly, radical ideas. As nice as it was to see that moment and the applause that came with it, you have to remember the history and direction of the Republican Party. And then he followed that immediately by dismissing transgender rights as a distraction. So I'm not really sure how progressive any of that really was.
Fortunately, a consortium of groups, including the National Center for Transgender Equality, bought ad time on the last night of the convention to make it clear that bathroom politics are anything but trivial.
I'm a transgender woman. I was born with a male body, but inside I always knew I was female. So I transitioned, and now I live every day as the woman I've always known myself to be. It can be hard to understand what it means to be transgender, especially if you've never met a transgender person. In most states, our laws don't protect transgender people from discrimination in public places or when it comes to using the restroom, something we all need to do every day. I've lived as a woman for many years. Most people, when they stop and think about it, they realize that when businesses can legally force me to use the men's room, it puts me at risk for harassment and violence. Safety and privacy in bathrooms are important for all of us. It's already illegal to enter a restroom to harm someone, and anyone who does that can and should be arrested. Updating the law to protect gay and transgender people from discrimination won't change that, but it would help to ensure that people like me aren't mistreated when we need to do something as basic as using the restroom.
The convention closed with Trump himself, who dished out another moment designed to warm the hearts of pro-LGBTQ voters.
Only weeks ago, in Orlando, Florida, 49 wonderful Americans were savagely murdered by an Islamic terrorist. This time, the terrorist targeted LGBTQ community. No good. And we're going to stop it. As your president, I will do everything in my power to protect our LGBTQ citizens from the violence and oppression of a hateful foreign ideology. Believe me. And I have to say, as a Republican, it is so nice to hear you cheering for what I just said. Thank you.
While the mention was groundbreaking by GOP standards, it should be noted that Trump's pledge to protect LGBTQ people from violence was in the context of a speech that stressed law and order with veiled references to Black Lives Matter protesters, hyped Islamophobia, despite the fact that the Pulse massacre shooter's connections to ISIS are vague at best, and promised no rescue from the domestic religious ideologies laid out in the party's platform. Andy Hum and Ann Northrup discuss some lowlights of that document.
Pornography is a public health crisis. Marriage should still be between a man and a woman. Children raised in traditional homes are healthier. Did you know that?
Coal is clean energy.
Yeah. Parents can force their LGBT children to undergo conversion therapy.
Mm-hmm.
Education includes a good understanding of the Bible.
which is indispensable for the development of an educated citizenry.
Even the Log Cabin Republican Club, which is trying to support Trump, basically, said this is the most anti-LGBT platform in the party's history. Phyllis Schlafly has been writing the social issues in the platform for many, many years.
But now it's the Family Research Council, Tony Perkins. And yeah. Tony Perkins has gotten carte blanche to write the Republican Party platform. Andy and I, for many years, have debated whether there is any point in paying any attention to party platforms. And my position has always been no. They're just there to appease the extreme wings of the party and give them something to crow about. And then the nominee and the people who are elected go blithely on their way and pay no attention to the party platform. But in this case, I would say the fact that the Trump people have made no effort to interfere with any of this and are perfectly content to let this stand, they're going to be beholden to these people.
Well, it'll be very hard to write a platform for Donald Trump since he's taken both sides of every single issue that's ever been in existence.
Now, only two?
That is not a joke.
I know.
That's exactly what he does.
Yeah.
We can find tape of him on both sides of every issue.
Several sides of every issue.
Yeah. But this is what the Republicans in Congress actually do when they
yes.
get power.
Yes.
Donald Trump has proposed judges to the court that have said we should allow states to ban same-sex marriage, ban sodomy again. It could be reinstated in this country in many states if these judges, enough of these judges, get on the court.
And
be alarmed, be afraid, be very afraid.
They don't give up. Just because we have legalized same-sex marriage in this country and passed some non-discrimination laws doesn't mean they accept that. They don't accept
yeah.
it.
We lost on sodomy in 1986, and the court upheld the right to ban sodomy, and it took 17 years to get that overturned by the Supreme Court, but it can be turned back.
And Trump really doesn't care about any of this stuff. All he cares about is some judge mistreating him in a business lawsuit. That's what he cares about. And his business is thriving and his brand increasing. So he doesn't have any well-formed opinions on any of this stuff. People keep asking him if he'll support the Equality Act, and no answer. And you know what Trump said about the really hideous anti-LGBT platform? It's very good.
That analysis of the Republican Party platform came from Ann Northrup and Andy Hum of Gay USA. The stage is now set for the Democratic Party's National Convention this week in Philadelphia. Presumptive presidential nominee Hillary Clinton predicts a different tone at their gathering.
Just remember, love trumps hate.
To the right, ever to the right.
Thanks for discovering This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. Wenzel Jones and John Dyer V contributed program material this week, with additional thanks to Democracy Now!, to Gay USA's Andy Hum and Ann Northrup, and as always, to Steve Pride. Some of the music you heard came from the Broadway musical 1776, and Kim Wolfson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Ivana Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our listener supporters, for making this show possible. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappell. We thank you for listening online at thiswayout.org and on 4BI Fortitude Valley, Queensland, WYHS Eau Claire, Wisconsin, KYRS Medicine Lake, Spokane, Washington, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Now, y'all, stay tuned.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
KPFA in Berkeley, California. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. We're often told that there's no alternative to capitalism in the state, that any attempt to try another way is just foolhardy. But historians have turned their attention to examples, ranging from pirates to escaped slaves, where groups of people have tried to create societies beyond the reach of the state and often the market. The authors of a new book have dived into debates about how societies have tried to organize themselves in the cracks of capitalism and out of the direct reach of the state, looking at Russian Cossacks, the Zapatistas in Chiapas, Mexico, and perhaps surprisingly, inhabitants of maximum security prisons. The book is titled Living at the Edges of Capitalism, Adventures in Exile and Mutual Aid. It's published by UC Press and written by Dennis O'Hearn and Andre Gribicic. They draw on the anarchist geographer Peter Kropotkin, who wrote about mutual aid, the ways that we work together to help each other collectively. And their book is a response of sorts to James Scott's The Art of Not Being Governed, an influential work about so-called non-state spaces. Andre Gribicic is professor of anthropology and social change at the California Institute of Integral Studies, and he joins me today. In the interest of full disclosure, I should say that Gribicic has been published by PM Press, which I'm connected to. Andre, what is the history of the study of exilic spaces, as you term them, or the study of non-state spaces?
The study of non-state spaces in anthropology has been something that is endemic to anthropology from the very beginning of anthropology as a social science. Kropotkin and many others made important inroads in developing notions of solidarity, notions of cooperation. Feminist Marxism has been extremely interesting in the way that it posits that it's not the technological innovation or change in technology, but change in the way that we live our lives, that really takes us beyond the capitalist valorization. And in that sense, I think that we belong, or our analysis aims to contribute to this burgeoning literature about these spaces, yes, but also practices, because we don't conceive space as something that's dead, emptied of time and movement. Space is a social process. We are very Lefebvrean in that sense. And we see what we call non-state spaces, or rather more accurately, exilic spaces and exilic practices, exilic societies. It's something that exists before capitalism, but what we have discovered, and this is a blind spot of so-called anarchist anthropology, was never really related to capitalism. So we have discovered that nobody, at least not to our knowledge, have tried to do an examination, a comparative study of non-state spaces within capitalist economy. And this, again, is where we had help, great help from Brodel, because in another book, he mentions an extremely interesting and really en passant, he doesn't dwell too much on it, the notion of black holes in the world economy. And he says, world economy is filled with black holes, meaning spaces that are outside of commercial exchange, spaces that are, he says, in inaccessible terrain, in mountainous or other terrains. And researching them is a fleeting, they have a fleeting presence, he believed. And researching them, he said, is like undertaking an underwater expedition, because they really, you can't find much about them. And our attempt was to say, no, I mean, this is fascinating. But yeah, we can actually study these spaces. And non-state spaces, as theorized by many anthropologists, as well as the institutions of and spaces of mutual aid, acquire a meaning only if we really relate them to the political economy of Brodel, if we think about them as these black holes in the world economy that at least to some extent stand outside of the capitalist processes of accumulation. But integrating them into history of capitalism is, as you have seen, of course, reading the book, not always an easy thing to do.
Okay, so let's talk concretely then about some examples of these exilic spaces. And as you emphasize, these spaces are not just geographic entities. Mm-hmm. They're not just sort of islands of non-capitalism, non-state, islands in a sea of capitalism. You focus in the book on several, you and your co-author, Dennis O'Hearn, and I should say that the book in question is called Living at the Edges of Capitalism, Adventures in Exile and Mutual Aid, and it's published by the University of California Press. I'm speaking with one of its co-authors, Andrei Grubicic, who teaches anthropology and social change at the California Institute of Integral Studies. And you're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, and I'm Sasha Lilly. So you focus on a number of different examples, some historical, some no longer with us, and some contemporary. In terms of the sort of prime contemporary example, and I will ask you a little later on about them, you look at the Zapatistas in Chiapas in Mexico. But you also look at the Don Cossacks. Tell our listeners who they are to start with. If people know anything about Cossacks, often for an American audience, the resonance is not a positive one because they have historically been associated with anti-Semitic pogroms, at least that's the image that comes down to most people. So tell us about the Cossacks and how they formed the exilic space that they did and what its characteristics were and when.
Yes, so we basically talk about three very different and distinct instances. One are the Cossacks before capitalism or before Russia, where place where Cossacks used to live, and they still do it under very different, as you said, very different conditions. Then the second instance, it is not only more contemporary, but is also, and we should probably talk a little bit more about that later, they're also a form of structural form of exile. And finally, the third instance is the instance of prisoners. Again, a comparative study of Turkish prisoners, Irish prisoners, famous Bobby Sands episode of the 1970s, and what might be interested to people from California, or listeners from California, prisoners in California, and especially in one supermax, in one prison, and that prison is Pelican Bay. Now, in terms of the Cossacks, Cossacks are just a fascinating example of a typical non-state space, non-state community that was created, again, specifically in order for people to escape the emerging processes of state formation in what used to be called Muscovy or Moscow, one of the many principalities at that time in Russia, and one of the many competing territorial fragments that is between, let's say, 13th and 15th century, maybe even 16th, going to become the most important center and the very center of the state formation in Russia. Now, Cossacks were people who, the word is Kazakh, the original word, were people who were non-state people defined by the fact that they escaped Russia. So if you read the sources, if you read the beautiful books that are written about the Cossacks, Brian Boyk, Imperial Boundaries, come immediately to mind, you will see that Cossacks were people who are those who escaped from Rus. And that is one of the most interesting thing about them. They completely refused ethnicity. And we can talk a little bit more about this later, because we read this as one of the state-preventing mechanisms, state-preventing strategies that people who inhabit these non-state spaces actually use. We focus on three. We say that they use voice, that they use loyalty, and that they use exit. Or perhaps they use exit, voice, and then loyalty. But the basic thing about the Cossacks is that they, the most important fragment of the Cossacks, territorial fragment, that is and truly crucial for the understanding of the unfolding history of Russia as a state, and later on Russia as a capitalist state, after it was incorporated into the processes of world markets and world capitalism, is that they existed on the River Don, or alongside the River Don. Today, I guess the closest city would be the former Stalingrad or Volgograd. And they have, as people who lived in the steppes, they have created a society around the notion of liberty. And liberty is extremely unusual, similar to the notion of autonomy that exists in Zapatista Chiapas. And this notion included direct systems of decision-making, what we can call direct democracy, the way that substantive economy was organized along the principles of communism and mutual aid, collectivization of surplus and so forth. And they created a truly incredible space of mutual aid, but as a non-state space that existed in opposition to Muscovy or to Moscow. What I think our book brings in terms of the Cossacks as somewhat new insight is that territorialization of rule, which means of the state, of the Muscovy, of Russia, would be completely impossible without the territorialization of exit or territorialization of escape of the Cossacks on Don River. Usually when you read about Cossacks, you read about horsemen, warriors, and stuff like that. Cossacks were nothing of the sort. They were pirates in the sense that Limbo and Redeker write about, historians of the Atlantic write about the pirates. They were people who created one of the many Maroons also come to mind.
Those runaway are the escape slaves.
Exactly. In Jamaica, but of course in many other places. These interstitial formations within, again, the emerging state system. And what they did, again, it's a pretty sophisticated political system that doesn't have anything to do with the state, and yet it's very much dependent on the state. In fact, we make the argument that the Cossack Don Society, they called it the river, the mapless community of the river, was constituted as part of the Russian state formation. The Russian state formation would be completely impossible without Don Cossacks, but also the sovereignty and the territorialization of escape of Cossacks would be impossible without Russian state. So we speak about this process of co-territorialization.
So can you explain that? Why would each be unimaginable without the other?
Exactly, because the thing about the Cossacks is that they were necessary for the Russian state in many ways, surrounded as it was by many enemies, Tatars to the south, Ottoman Empire, and they played a crucial role, especially with regards to Ottoman Empire and different diplomatic maneuvers that Russian state had to undergo with regards to Ottoman Empire, but also, especially at the beginning, to prevent Russian state from being destroyed from the south by Tatars. So the whole Russian push to the south would be impossible without Cossacks defending frontiers of Russia. Now, later on, of course, there was Peter the Great, and Cossacks helped Peter build the navy. They played extremely important role in his conquest of the city called Azov, which was very important commercially in those days. And later on, in the many campaigns in 18th century, after they were already statified or incorporated within Russian society. The interesting thing, of course, was, and we have to ask, why would Cossacks do that? Cossacks did that because they made a very interesting and very explicit agreement with Russian state that we in the book called the loyalty bargain. Mm-hmm. And then we believe that loyalty bargain is something that each non-state or exilic space needs to make in order to survive. One of the common predicaments of spaces that exist outside of capitalism, before capitalism, or within capitalism, is that they need to make agreement, they need to make, to establish what we call loyalty or dependence on extra space actors. In the case of Cossacks, unlike the case of prisoners, and unlike the case of probably most significant the Zapatistas in Mexico, they have created a relationship of strategic dependence on the Russian state. Russian state would send them subsidies. Cossacks, who are refugees from serfdom, did not like agriculture, and agriculture was not allowed because it brought inequality, was not allowed in the Cossack territory. So the subsidy, it was called the annual subsidy that Cossacks would receive, was actually also a way of creating the Cossack community, and it arrived from the Russian state. What the Russian state demanded in return was the protection of its frontiers. So Cossacks, in a sense, not only helped create Russian state, but they helped create a strong Russian state. And without the Cossacks on the River Don, this particular fragment of Cossacks, the history of Russian state, in my opinion, would have been looked very different.
So then bearing in mind the dependency that the Don Cossacks were wrapped up in with the Russian state, why do you look to them, and making this point, as we will see as we talk about the kind of compromises and bargains that these sorts of non-state spaces tend to be forced to make with outside powers, in effect, the state and capitalism. So given all of that, why do you look at these as liberatory examples on some level? What you've been describing seems in some way very deeply compromised.
Well, yes and no. I mean, again, I don't think it's deeply compromised. Of course, you can loyalty bargain is a complicated thing. In order for non-state spaces to survive, and when I use the term non-state space, I'm talking about spaces before the encroachment or incorporation into capitalist world economy. After the incorporation into capitalist world economy, I would use, and I will explain why, the term space of escape or exilic space. But non-state spaces, in order to survive, and when I say in order to survive, I do so because they face something that in the book we call the exit without resources trap or exit in isolation trap. They simply don't have the means, enough means to survive, agriculture, food, guns in the case of the Cossacks. So they make a bargain with the state. For example, Maroons in Jamaica are an interesting example. Maroons said most people don't like to talk about this, but Maroons, in order to be able to survive, Maroons, again, to remind the listeners, are refugee slaves, slaves who escaped enslavement in colonial situations, and Jamaica is always a good example because now Maroons still exist as a privileged ethnic minority. They were transformed into ethnicity within, and this is another thing that we should definitely talk about a little bit more. They had, and they made, they struck a loyalty bargain with the state to deliver slaves who would, runaway slaves, who would escape after the agreement was reached. So you had a society of escaped slaves that would return the slaves, the new slaves, back to the plantation, because that was the agreement, the loyalty bargain, with the state or with the plantation system, and that is the only way for them to survive. So what is the liberatory potential? Well, what we were thinking about is mostly to understand how capitalism works. And how capitalism works is, I think, it's simply not enough to focus on social movements, to focus only or exclusively on these huge outbursts or channeled, organized outbursts that many people in the people call social movements or anti-systemic movements or counter movements or what have you. We actually think that there is something that we called the infrapolitics of capitalist world economy. Now, it sounds like a mouthful, but it actually is a very interesting process. And we believe that this process actually describes this regular, historically regular process of breaking away from systemic processes of capital and the state. And these processes, these Brodelian black holes or these Clastrian non-state spaces or exilic spaces in our language, are spaces that present serious obstacles to capitalist accumulation. They are partially incorporated into capitalism, and they're also, for that matter, partially or only partially autonomous. And this is something that has been constantly neglected in the history of capitalism or even in the history of contention throughout capitalism. And we think that this logic of infrapolitics of capitalist world economy, of this state deformation, of destruction of states, in a sense, is something that fragmentation, is something that we haven't been paying enough attention in anthropology, in sociology, or in world history.
Historical social scientist Andrei Gribicic is my guest. I'll return with him in just a moment. You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is Sasha Lilly, and today I'm speaking to the co-author of Living at the Edges of Capitalism, Adventures in Exile and Mutual Aid. It's published by UC Press, and its authors are Andrei Gribicic, who joins me today, and Dennis O'Hearn. Andrei teaches anthropology and social change at the California Institute of Integral Studies. He's also the author of Wobblies and Zapatistas. And we're talking about attempts, historic and contemporary, by people to break away from capitalism in different forms. And so I'd like to turn to talking about the Zapatistas, the example that many listeners will know the most, who, starting in 1994, have established a large community in Chiapas, Mexico, where they have tried to reshape the lives of people living there. How do they fall into your category of exilic spaces, and what do you think is particularly notable about the Zapatista experience?
I'm sure you hate when the people you interview answer like this, but I have to go back long time. Go back to my arguments and to the very way that we set up our arguments in this. One of our main interlocutors in all of this is a famous anthropologist by the name of James Scott. He's a professor at Yale. And James Scott is somebody who extended the search or research of non-state spaces, spaces where people escape, again, from the processes of state formation or from the state spaces in order to create these entities that we call non-state spaces.
Especially in his book, The Art of Not Being Governed.
The most important book in that sense is The Art of Not Being Governed, published, I believe, in 2009, but it's not the only one. I mean, if you look at Jim's work, his book about seeing like a state is very much part of the same kind of interest. And in many ways, he follows the French anthropologist Pierre Claster, who was the author of the book Society Against the State. And what we try to do in dialogue with Jim is to understand why is it that whenever anthropologists write about non-state spaces, they never talk about capitalism. And they never really address the notions of world market or this wider process that Braudel calls, famous French historian, who probably is the best-known historian in the English-speaking world, he calls it the world time, and the way that, of course, these are all the changes and everything that happens throughout the involvement and the evolution of capitalist world economy.
So you're saying that people focusing on non-state spaces, they look at the state, but they don't look at the market in assessing
exactly
these communities' relationship to the so-called outside world.
Exactly. Fernando Coronilo, and he wrote one of the funniest and wittiest critiques of Jim Scott, that it's seeing like a state, smelling like a market. And he tried to understand how is it, and this is to some extent what we are trying in a very friendly and comradely way to understand too, how is it possible to say that, for example, non-state spaces don't exist anymore? And Scott, who is actually famous for his infectious optimism, and sometimes people would accuse him of romanticism and all sorts of good things, I guess, he ends up on a very pessimistic note. He actually says, well, non-state spaces don't exist anymore. And the reason why they don't exist is because this global administration of the state that just becomes bigger and bigger, more bloated, is actually now brought everybody to the heel, I think is the expression that he uses, enclosed, and he actually makes the explicit use of the term enclosure, enclosed all of these spaces, and now we are all, in this kind of Foucauldian sense, somehow globally administered. There is nothing. So his analysis is primarily geographical. There is something that he calls friction of terrain, which means that people go and escape, and they escape to mountains, they escape to jungles, they escape to inaccessible places, and civilization or state runs out of breath, he says at some point, because it can't reach them. And now it can, because it has developed this distance demolishing technologies. And the problem with this whole thing is, line of reasoning, which is fascinating in so many ways, is yes, but only if you really think about a state as something that's basically an agrarian state that only becomes bigger through time and increases its capacities of control and administration. But state surely is much more than that, especially under capitalism. Under capitalism, we have a situation where states are being organized into an interstate system in order to protect and to impose the international law of value. They're not just a random collection of entities. They exist in order to enforce or to create conditions for what we might call endless accumulation of capital, which is what capitalism really is all about. So without a theorization of historical capitalism, of interstate system, which are essential for the maintenance of historical capitalism, one cannot really hope to understand what happens to non-state spaces. Or maybe one can understand that non-state spaces then really ceased to exist when capitalism appeared, which is not what Jim Scott is saying. Again, capitalism makes appearance only, I think, in the preface of the book. But I think the interesting thing about all of this is he basically says, not in those words, that capitalism, that non-state spaces and people belong to a previous world time. They don't exist anymore because there are no conditions for them. So the way for us to break through that is to say, hey, well, if you think about capitalism, and then you need to think not only about geographical exile, geographic escape, you also need to talk about structural escape. And if we talk about structural escape, then you will see a plethora of activities, exilic activities we call them, that exist within the interstices, within the cracks of capitalism as a historical system. And one of the most interesting of them, contemporary, is of course the one in southern Mexico, in the place called Chiapas, in Mexican, the very south of Mexico, where indigenous, or largely, almost completely indigenous group of Mexican peasants came together in 1994, although the organization, the setting up of the organization, of course, was a long-term process, to create a situation that they called, referred to as autonomy, very much or very similar to the one, to the liberty of the Cossack, which is also territorially based, but it inhabits this really paradoxical location because it is within capitalist system and in many ways outside of the Mexican state. It is a self-governed territory. It actually, going back to Jim Scott, it corresponds to almost all of the diagnostic characteristics for a non-state space. Jim says somewhere in The Art of Not Being Governed that all of these spaces are distinguished by, number one, their location. The first rule of escape, he says, is geography. Second, by the, he calls it agriculture of escape, meaning that people employ different kinds of agriculture that allows them to escape. Then decentralized, fluid political structure. Then rebellious, and this is a very interesting point, collective identities. Finally, rebellious cosmology. If you look at the Zapatistas, all of these diagnostic patterns are there. I would say we are not talking only about escape agriculture, just like Cossacks were, we are talking about escape, full-blown escape economy and production. But it's still very interesting, and it's interesting that he is not able to see, and many other people who follow in his footsteps, not able to see Zapatistas, for example, as exactly the model of a society that exists in the opposition of Mexico, which they call mal gobierno, the bad state of Mexico, the bad government, and that is organized completely autonomously.
Well, for listeners who may not be deeply familiar with the Zapatistas, clearly they have created some kind of autonomy from the Mexican state. But to what degree have they created autonomy from capitalism or transformed the basic principles that people's lives and work are being governed along?
Now we are going back to the, I think, crux of your question. How can we think about the spaces as utopian possibilities? There is a usual mistake that many radicals make. The many people who are activist scholars, people who are just activists who visit Zapatistas or similar regions. Zapatistas are not the only one. One that I'm trying to pay a lot of attention to is Rojava in Kurdistan or in the Kurdish parts of Syria. Another recent territorial non-state fragment.
Right, famously fighting off ISIS.
Famously fighting off ISIS, also making all sorts of compromises. You remember that they were criticized recently by many people on the radical left for making a sort of a compromise with the American military, which was providing them with weapons and so on and so forth. But in terms of the Zapatistas, people usually have this idea, or in terms of the Cossacks, or in terms of any other kind of space where people experience, where people escape processes of state control or capitalist regulation, they believe that these spaces are somehow completely delinked from capitalist world economy. One example is one of my favorite writers from Latin America, Raul Zibeki, who is trained, I believe, as a journalist in Uruguay. And he wrote two books that have been published in the United States, Dispersing Power and Territories in Resistance. These books exercised a lot of influence on many people on the activist left, on the horizontalist activist left, post-Occupy activist left. And they are truly remarkable books. But in these books, which are mostly about, he doesn't make the same mistake that I believe Jim Scott is making. He is actually studying contemporary urban non-state spaces. This is the language that he's using. And he's talking about spaces in, for example, El Alto, where 70% of people are almost disengaged, or in his words, completely disengaged from formal economy, and they're doing things that are outside of the rhythms of division of labor and capitalism and
this
all of
that. Bolivia.
This is in Bolivia. But of course his claim is more general and it's related to Latin America. Now, the problem with all of this is that Raul, as many others, presupposes, or at least that would be my reading, complete independence from the of these spaces and activities that exist in these spaces from the processes of capitalist accumulation. And that, to my mistake, to my reading of these experiences, is a mistake. I think that these people and these spaces definitely participate in the world economy, but it doesn't take anything away from them. So there is a sort of a utopian need to give them some kind of purity situation, but they're free of any contradiction whatsoever. But I think this is a mistake, and actually don't think that we are doing them any favors.
Okay, because, but bearing that contradictory aspect of things in mind, the fact that these experiments are taking place in places where the capitalist world economy operates. So with the assumption that these are not going to be pure forms of a post-capitalist world, what in particular do you find liberatory about them, utopian about them, and what degree are they even partially operating outside of the dictates of the market and capitalism?
So you have chosen, picked probably the most hopeful example of all three examples that are in the book. Zapatistas are engaged in what we call in the book contradictory substantive practices in relation specifically to your question, meaning to economy. And that means that they are involved in activities that support capital. They're not in direct opposition to the law of value, but at the same time, they are deeply transformative. So when I say contradictory substantive practices, I'm using a term that we came up with in the book that refers to those activities, those economic practices that are at the same time supportive of capital and limited capital. They are used as very, and this is very interesting, as capital-resisting strategies. But at the same time, they do involve Zapatistas, for example, in the world economy through solidarity economy, world trade networks. Zapatistas are famous for selling coffee, and I believe most of our listeners at some point or another had a Zapatista coffee produced fair trade coming from Chiapas. They also sell most of their goods, and there's a lot of manufacturing of artisanal products. They're sold in different places in Chiapas. They're sold even outside of Chiapas. Many people who live in Zapatista territory lives off remittances, money that has been sent by people, members of the Zapatista communities who actually work in the United States. There's a lot of seasonal work of Zapatista villagers who go to places like Tabasco and work in oil fields. There is a lot of dependency on things, on economic activities that are not directly, explicitly communal. Now, the real question about all of this, at least again in our analysis, is what do people do with surplus, if surplus exists?
Sure.
How is it being used? How is it being collectivized, if it's being collectivized? What is the relationship with private property, if it exists? And it does exist. In Zapatista territory, there is a sort of uneasy existence between private property and communal property. Well, Zapatistas are actually collectivizing surplus, and they are reinvesting whatever, so when they meet the sustenance, but everything that remains is being reinvested in different collective projects. It's being used to acquire, for example, machinery for villages, for things that are missing. Or they're being in, and this is truly beautiful, sent to places like Salvador Atenco or Cuba or other places that are in need. So another very important aspect is that most of this production actually rests on the work of women. Through this production, especially of the artisanal goods, women are actually forming cooperatives and breaking through the certain patriarchal norms of the indigenous society of Chiapas. There's a tremendous sense of empowerment that comes with this. Now, of course, again, the fact that these practices are linked to the processes of capitalist market doesn't at the same time mean or imply that they cannot be transformative. In the case of the Zapatistas, they're deeply transformative. They're creating a capital and state resisting practices in the community. They are related to a more general way of organizing life in the Zapatista territory, which we choose to call exilic space or another instance of an exilic space. And they provide us with one of the most tenacious examples of autonomy or exile in the contemporary world. So the interesting thing about this, and I'm going back to Kropotkin here, and one thing that I perhaps forgot to mention, is that one of the insights of Kropotkin was that people who practice mutual aid are people who have most chances to survive. And that was his hope, that was his observation, and I think that actually served us well to think about this while writing this book. And one of our central findings really is that in these communities that practice mutual aid, these are the communities that resist incorporative pressures coming from state and capital. Because whenever you move away to the edge of capitalism, there is incorporative pressure coming from states and capital to pull you back in. The way to avoid doing that is, and this is the interesting question, is to create a relationship that will allow you the maximum possible space for autonomy. So there is no complete delinking from, in a sense that Egyptian economist Samir Amin would use that word, from the processes of capitalist world economy here. But we do have spaces that are only partially incorporated into capitalism, and they're making a deliberate attempt to move even further away. The question of why are they, and maybe we can talk about this later, but for me, one of the most fascinating questions, of course, was why Chiapas? Why there? And why was it, why now? Because Chiapas, for those listeners who are not familiar with the history of Zapatismo, really begins with 1994 and with imposition of the Mexican, of the North American Trade Agreement. One of our presidential hopefuls was active in
NAFTA.
Back then, in imposing this agreement. And this is a long history. And the question, again, is this becomes completely incomprehensible if you don't relate all of these practices to the changes. So slight, sounds slightly too much of like a political economist right now, cyclical downturns in world economy. And really when I think that what Dennis and myself were able to do really well is to make the case that it's impossible to understand the logic of non-state spaces or exilic spaces outside of the world time without the connection to world capitalism.
Right, and that's one of the themes that runs through your book, Living at the Edges of Capitalism, Adventures in Exile and Mutual Aid, and that is that these exilic spaces cannot be understood without looking at the dynamics of the larger capitalist system, that they're not just sort of islands bobbing out on the water separate from all of these things.
Not at all. And I think that in my understanding of capitalism, I think that we're talking about unitary world economy that does not allow a complete outside. However, the implication of that is that it also does not allow a complete insight. So we are talking about processes of incorporation into the capitalist world economy, the way that capitalism expands. And one of the main arguments of the book is that that these spaces, these famous black holes, non-state spaces that become exilic spaces during incorporation into capitalism, are actually specific products of incorporation into capitalism.
And I'd like to ask you more about that in a moment. Andrei Grubicic is my guest. He teaches anthropology and social change at the California Institute of Integral Studies. My name is Sasha Lilly, and the program is Against the Grain. So isn't it, though, the case, Andre, that capitalism, by its very nature, is always about constantly plumbing the depths or crossing the frontiers of parts of human life that have previously been unincorporated? I mean, that capitalism's tremendous dynamism, whatever you think of it as a system, has been based on this constant commodification. And so in essence, it needs these places that are not commodified and then commodifies them. And so it's almost, rather than the two being polar opposites, that for capitalism, it's actually part of the dance that it depends on.
If I understood your question correctly, yes. But I would say that this is a, you know, as Brodel always reminds us, this is a dialectical process that's always contested and negotiated. Capitalism never is successful at commodifying everything. And I would say this is the reason for hope, and this is one of the messages of the book, is that we are talking about this process of, you're talking about the frontiers, right, about the way that capitalism expands. The term that I use and like is the term incorporation, and it actually means making what is external internal. Capitalism, with its beginnings in Europe, slowly or quickly, depending on your patience with history, expands, and it swallows other parts of the world, integrates them into the system-wide division of labor, makes them part of the, reorganize them so they can actually allow for the flow of people and commodities and allow for the processes of accumulation on a world scale. Now, problem with all of this is that incorporation is sometimes seen as an in and out process. Once you become part of capitalism, there is no way out. It's just like this big monster that swallows up everything. And that is not my understanding of incorporation. My understanding of this, capitalism is truly, of course, expanding, but rather than being an in and out process, it's a gradual process, it's an uneven process, it's a partial process, it's an incomplete process. You mentioned Chiapas, you mentioned Zapatistas, and I a few seconds ago said that it's very interesting to think about why now and why Chiapas. Eastern Chiapas is a place that was never completely incorporated into the capitalist world economy. It was also never really incorporated into the system of centralized Mexican government. There are places in Chiapas, in eastern Chiapas, that are produced in a particular way because that space was actually never completely conquered by state and capital. And people who lived there, mostly indigenous, were left to their own devices. They even called themselves the forgotten ones because they were forgotten by the state, which then, because of this, became the bad government. And because of this people actually had the opportunity, exposed to this improvisational way of life without really the intrusion of the state, to create a space that became an obstacle to capitalist accumulation in the region, regional processes of capital accumulation. And that's tremendously interesting. So one of the things that we are saying is, and this might be slightly controversial in certain circles, is that incorporation itself, or the way that interstate system of states is being defined, is through the struggle against non-state spaces. Really, it's incorporation itself, it's not only a process of integrating new territories into the system-wide division of labor. It's also a process of specifically eliminating alternatives to capitalism, which means non-state exilic spaces. And the fact that these spaces persist, or fact that these spaces actually come to life as a response to these processes of incorporation, is exactly what makes incorporation into capitalism an incomplete, gradual, uneven, and contradictory process. So this is a, I believe, a slightly new take on what incorporation separation actually means. And of course, we cannot make, or we do not wish to make, the case that non-state spaces completely decide the way that a place is being incorporated into ever-expanding capitalist economy. But we do believe, and especially in the case of Russia, that we have shown how non-state spaces decisively influence the particular form of incorporation that occurs in a certain place. And in case of Russia, that was what we refer to as semi-peripheral incorporation into capitalist world economy. Basically, the Cossacks were agents of their own demise, who created or helped create a very powerful Russian state, not too powerful, but powerful enough to be integrated into capitalist organization of labor and life in a way that is not peripheral, but semi-peripheral.
Well, let me ask you about another exilic space that you focus on, which might surprise some listeners. It's one that has taken place in parts of the world that are entirely integrated into capitalism, and that, unlike the Zapatistas or the Cossacks, one couldn't say are intentional communities. And that is the spaces and communities of people who are in maximum security prisons. How does that fit in with this story?
Now, with prisoners, we are dealing with a very different case that, again, nobody asks about but you. Why prisoners? Which is very interesting. Because we are talking about a forced exile. And we can make a distinction between voluntary, and of course this serves as an approximation, but between voluntary and involuntary exile. With case of prisoners, we are definitely dealing with people who are first exiled from the society itself. Then, again, we are not talking only about prisoners in the book. More specifically, we are talking about prisoners who find themselves in the situation of solitary confinement. And these people are then exiled even further to the depths of capitalism. So one of the reviewers of our book said, how on earth are you able to make the case that the institution that's the very heart of capitalism is somehow at the edges of capitalism? And I think that we actually can, because if you bring the world-changing world economy into the way that prisons are being produced, the role of prisons has been changed, or the strategies of incarceration has been changed tremendously since the so-called World Revolution of 1968, what I would see as a decline of American hegemony, and response to counter state insurgencies, political groups that came together to form a serious threat to the establishment. And that created a new form or new strategy of dealing with insurgencies and then of recreating prisons. So in a sense, and what makes the spaces at the edges of capitalism is the fact that they were able, in these three cases that we were examining, Irish, Turkish, and Supermax in the United States, to create exilic communities, meaning communities based on mutual aid, that were appropriating spaces of prisons and creating a truly incredible sense of community that transcends identity, limitations of race, and limitations of all of these other forms that prisoners who call themselves part of the prisoner class, which is a fascinating term, have chosen to actually confront. So they were able to create in these spaces of total stripping, to use the term that's popular among theorists of prison, they were able to create a situation of communal solidarity that in many of its diagnostic features actually resembles those in Chiapas and those in the Don region of Russia. The Irish case is especially advanced, but the most interesting probably is the case of the American prisoners in Supermax prisons.
We're entirely out of time. I've been speaking with Andrei Grubicic. He is co-author with Dennis O'Hearn of Living at the Edges of Capitalism, Adventures in Exile and Mutual Aid. That's published by UC Press, and you can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. Andrei Grubichich teaches anthropology and social change at the California Institute of Integral Studies. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks for listening. And please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.